Gone from 3 Days Grace, our number one song for the fourth straight week.
Well, that does it for us this week. Thanks to Patrick from the Black Keys for stopping by. Also, Jacoby and Jerry from Papa Roach.
Look for the entire interview with the guys up at thesideshowcountdown.com, and you can find our chart up there as well.
That's it for us.
I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem. See ya.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Nobody ever told her it's the wrong way. Don't be afraid of the quickness you get laid. For your family, get paid. It's the wrong way. I give her all that I have to give. I'm gonna make it hard to live. Salty tears running down to her chin.
WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I got to turn on my microphone.
You know,
don't I? And I don't know.
Details, Peter.
And Jolene is chewing taffy, so I don't know if she can. You're all right.
I'm all right.
You ready for the program?
Yeah, you know.
Welcome to the broadcast. It's in some ways, too bad we're not doing a sports show, given what's been going on around here. And don't call with sports questions, because this is WRIF's public affairs program, and we're supposed to talk about the issues of the day, although we'd love to talk about the Tigers, the Lions winning in overtime.
The Tigers won.
The Tigers won.
We visit things. I mean, this is our hometown pride, Peter.
Michigan, just took care of business, and it was Michigan State. But we'll go on from there. You're happy they got beat by Iowa.
No.
You don't have that kind of way back allegiance, huh?
No, I don't.
That's good.
I did go to college there, but
you were born there.
Yeah, I was born there. And
you're corn fed.
I have to say, our general manager of this radio station also went to the University of Iowa, so we like when he's happy.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Sorry for our teams.
Well, be that what it may, whatever that phrase means, we would like you to join us in our discussion for the next couple of hours. And at 1 a.m., there's going to be a couple of very interesting interviews. And you can go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, if you're like me in the 20th century. If you're in the 21st century, you can go to our Facebook. That's facebook.com/nightcall. And by the way, those of you who have subscribed to our podcast through iTunes, mm-hmm. I don't know what the hell happened. But anyway, you can do it again. And there was something. It was somewhere or other. It was on as Night Call with a space in the middle. It's one word. Anyway, you may have to resubscribe or just go to WRIF.com and go to the podcast.
/podcast.
Yeah, or go to my website, PeterWerby.com, and you can subscribe there. It'll wind up in your mailbox every Monday around noon when Mike and Calvin now put
and,
it.
And when I finally get
to it. And when Jalene finally gets to it and wants to say that. It's usually available.
You're so kind.
By noon, yeah. On the air I am. but it should be available at noon on Monday. And our phone number, 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743.
Now, I was watching, was it the same night? Yeah, that was the same night as the Oakland A's and the Tigers mm-hmm. were playing, that Joe Biden and Paul Ryan were
right.
debating. So I was switching channels. I was watching every time the Tigers were at bat and every time Biden spoke.
That's
although Verlander, you know, was pitching such an incredible game. Someone said, well, you missed all that. So anyway, after a while, I stopped even watching the debate, right?
Yeah.
I mean, those debates are so lame.
Well, I can't sit there and actually watch a whole debate.
I don't know what it does for people. I mean, the whole fact that they're saying the Romney campaign has been reinvigorated because Obama was so lackadaisical.
Yeah.
And now he's ready to go again. He's a tiger. They got a tiger in his tank.
You know, he's made fun of himself, actually, about his poor performance.
But, you know, this is just such showbiz.
It is.
And the networks and the people that sell the advertising are just going crazy. Because now, I mean, think about
how many people want to watch this one?
Yeah, and I'm going to go play handball in my league, like I always do on Tuesdays. But anyway, I did want to see what everybody thought about the debate between Biden
about
and Ryan.
Biden smiling.
So I started watching MSNBC that had all the liberals on there, and also this one.
All the liberals.
Yeah, all the this is his name, Joe Schmidt or somebody. He was Sarah Palin's. He had something to do with, what was that other guy that ran against Obama?
McCain?
McCain, thank you, McCain, and Sarah Palin. And so he's on there, and they're all, you know, saying that, that Joe mopped the floor with Ryan and all that. And then I turned on CBS and then CNN, and I thought, oh, CNN, that's right next to Fox Noise.
Yeah.
And I started watching, I was fascinated. All they did, endlessly talk about Biden, how much he was smiling, how rude he was. I know Joe Biden. What? There's some guy in there. I don't know. Brett Hume. That's it. I know Joe Biden, and he's a fine man, and I like him very much. But I was appalled at the way he kept interrupting and the way he kept mugging and smiling.
Overanalyzing something.
And then there's some woman, Gretchen, somebody or other, in there. I don't know. You know, she's
one of the people that
does not look like a porn star on Fox News.
I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because there's only one.
Yeah.
There's only one non-porn star.
Yeah. And she was just, you realize, oh, he kept smiling and smiling.
He did that last time.
And I don't know what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. I mean, certainly,
you're going to be either too angry or too mad. There's no, you know, you can't win with these.
I mean, in the Senate 170 years ago or so, one senator attacked another guy with a cane. You know, things have gotten a little better.
Yeah, a little more.
Than that for sure.
Polite.
But, you know, think about showbiz again. Show business deal. Mm-hmm. Why in the world were they even having a split screen? Now, Joe Biden knew absolutely.
That's all for effect.
Yeah. He knew he was on camera, obviously, right? And everything was incredibly calculated. And I just hesitated a second like that because you notice the lights kind of flickered again?
Did they?
Yeah. We had a total blackout here, folks. It didn't affect.
About 15 minutes before showtime.
Yeah. Just everything went out. Jalene was coming up in the parking lot, and all the lights went out in the whole building.
I thought I'd been struck by lightning. I thought the supposed God finally struck me down.
Well, here, Yahoo News, Joe Biden's smiling. Was there a method to his madness? And then
yes.
Yeah, and then he went on. You know, they went on about that and analyzing it. And who cares? Who effing cares?
Yes, seriously.
Just why? You know what? They have... I mean, it would probably run up against the First Amendment. But there should be a law that these campaigns are 3 weeks long. I mean, does any of you there need a year's campaign, 6 months campaign,
I think four months campaign? It's pretty clear where these guys stand on the issues, except when they, you know, the Mitt Romney
keeps Etch-a-sketch.
Kind of changing
every day.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons maybe Obama couldn't answer, because he kept saying, well, wait a minute. He didn't say that last time. He probably thought he was going to go for his total right wing thing that mm-hmm. he had changed from his liberal Republican thing into this total right wing thing. He said he was an extreme conservative. I don't think that was the adjective, but something like that. Romney. Yeah. And then his campaign manager says, oh, these primaries are like an etch a sketch. We'll just shake it all up. And now he's got to convince people that he's not a right wing crazoid like the majority of people in the Republican Party, particularly the elected officials and those running.
Well, he's working on it.
Yeah.
He's working on that.
Yeah. Well, like, for instance, Romney promised that there would be no legislation on abortion.
Yeah, and that is something I don't believe him.
Yeah. He said, in fact, speaking about Iowa, as we were earlier, he told the Des Moines Register, there's no legislation with regard to abortion that I'm familiar with that would become part of my agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be true, because you've got to remember, on one hand, Romney said he, over and over again in Massachusetts, that he supported a woman's right to choose, all of that. And now, you know, he says he's completely against it. He wants to reverse Roe v. Wade. That said, what a concept that this was an issue of privacy, medical privacy between a woman and her doctor, not a bunch of right-wing white guys that are 50 years old. I mean, they have abortions for all their mistresses, right? They wouldn't want to, you know, they say for rape, incest, the mother's health, and when a Republican legislator's
having an affair,
mistress is pregnant. Those are the only four exceptions that they'll have.
Yeah, so he's.
I know Democratic guys have, but you know what? They're not self-righteous. They're not sanctimonious. They're not talking about the Lord all the time, and then hanging out with prostitutes. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe they hang out with prostitutes. You know, like the governor of New York. What was his name? Now he's got a TV show.
Oh, was it that? No, that's not the Sanford one. That was.
No. This was a Democrat.
You just can't keep them all straight.
We need a scorecard. Or we need a monitor.
A dirty scorecard.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Wait a minute here.
Dirtier.
I expect to see that down in this little box here we have. Once in a while, they'll...
What you're talking about is our producers talk to us from the other room.
That's right.
I expect to see this in this little box down there. People are like, what?
A little box on the floor. It's called a wastebasket.
You're right.
Right. Well, anyway, Romney promised no abortion legislation that would limit a woman's right to choose, but he is bound and determined, as any Republican president would, to put onto the Supreme Court of the United States another far right-wing judge
to become
a justice.
When he says promises no abortion legislation, well, that's a pretty big piece of legislation, I would say.
Yeah. And but if you had just a few more Catholics on there, or a few more right-wing jurists, mm-hmm. you could overturn that, and you could and then the United States would be unlike any other country in North America or Europe or whatever, and be like every country in South America.
Yeah, it makes me shudder.
Yeah, it does indeed. So, reasons, I mean, there's so many people on the left that are so disappointed in Obama that he didn't live up to many of the promises that he said. A lot of it, you know, of course, he was blocked by the Republicans, things about jobs, you know, jobs bill and what have you, and the fact that, that these state legislators that are under the control of Republicans lay off more and more public workers, which, guess what, it adds to the unemployment rolls. Anyway, did we talk about this last week? There was a study in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology that found that providing free birth control dramatically reduced the number of abortions in Missouri women and teenagers at high risk of unplanned pregnancies.
We did not talk about that.
So this is the way to stop abortion. You have
birth control.
Free birth control available. What do you think about that, folks? 313-298-WRIF. You know, it's funny, these folks... let me see.
And not just that, Peter. It's about, you know, health care for women in general.
Yeah. Dr. James T. Breeden, president of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, told the Associated Press, it's just an amazing improvement. I would think if you were against abortions, you would be 100% for contraception access.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's not about that. It's really about a war on women. It's really about misogyny, which is the hatred of women. No, I love women.
Yeah.
Particularly when they're barefoot and pregnant.
Right.
You know.
Or naked in your bed.
Yeah, actually, a lot of people don't like them when they're pregnant. So that's just goodbye.
That's just goodbye.
Yeah. 313-298-WRIF. Bruce Springsteen out on the campaign trail again for Obama in Ohio and in Iowa. I was listening to this wacky Sunday night right-wing talk show host that comes from Cincinnati. I'm not going to mention his name or the station.
Don't do it.
And he's playing Bruce Springsteen music, sort of as bumper music. Bumper music, tell him what that is.
That's music going in and out of the segments, commercials, and back into the show.
So I'm thinking, is this guy, doesn't he understand this?
Doesn't he understand that Springsteen is not down with this guy's program?
No, I don't know.
He's a good lefty.
Yeah, he is indeed. In fact,
this is great that he's doing, and he's joining former President Bill Clinton at a rally in Parma, Ohio, as a matter of fact, and announced later that they would at another stop in Ames, Iowa, where I also went to college.
More news where the spectacle meets politics for a while. I think this has gone away, though. This is from Wednesday, October 10th, but I think this has all gone away. What was the Romney slogan? He had some, not take back
America. Which one?
Well, he had one, but then, he put together this one called Clear Eyes and Full Hearts and America Can't Lose. And what that was, it was taken from this TV series called Friday Night Lights.
I've never seen it, but I know.
I'm always partying on Friday night. I'm never home watching the telly.
I know, you are not home.
Aren't I out every Friday?
Every Friday.
Every Friday.
I try to find you, and I can never find you.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to put a GPS on you, Peter.
Well, anyway, that's what the coach of the football team in the fictional Dillon High School in rural Texas would build up the Panthers, the team there, by saying, clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. So the Romney slogan became, and it was on his website, clear eyes and full hearts and America can't lose.
He has to take it from some dumb TV show. This guy has no original thought whatsoever.
Well, then the producers of this said, hey, dude, no.
He keeps getting turned down.
He does.
Musicians.
Yeah, he does. But I don't even get that. Now,
I don't either. It's just stupid.
I mean, it's an advertising slogan, obviously. But what in the world does that mean? Clear eyes. I mean,
and
this is political.
Hearts.
Clear eyes and full hearts.
I think he's trying to open your eyes, America, because the way it's going now, blah, blah, blah. And the full hearts thing, he's just full of BS.
Yeah.
You know, he does not have a heart. He doesn't have a heart for human beings. He doesn't have a heart for women and children. He doesn't have a heart for the poor. He doesn't have a heart for animals.
So.
Dog abuser.
Oh, dog abuser. I forgot about that.
I'll never forget about it.
Seamus, riding on...
top of the car.
Top of the car.
12 hours.
Yeah, go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and there's a great video on there. It said, Hitler hears that Romney put his dog on top of his car.
Hitler was angry.
Did we talk about that last...
We did.
Oh, yeah, the Untergangers.
Oh, that's such... I mean, that video cracked me up.
But, I'll tell you, that comes from this movie called The Downfall.
Not a funny movie.
Not a funny. It's Hitler's last 12 days in a bunker with all the boys, Goebbels and the gang. And it is there's not a lot of slaughter, and it's not about the concentration camps, but it is so profoundly disturbing and such an incredible performance by Bruno Ganz, the German actor who acts
who
in...
Played him.
It's about his
maniacal... thoughts.
That he's going to keep fighting, and he thinks all these mystery armies are going to come repel the Russians and all that. But to know that there are people that walk among us, because, this book that Hannah Arendt wrote, it was called The Banality of Evil. Like when you think of a person that has committed tremendously evil acts, serial killer or killer of one person, or Hitler or Stalin or somebody like that, you think just, that it would just ooze evil at every second. But it is just the guy next door always, but that somehow commits an act, or in the case of these political leaders, gets the power of the political state and can make men and sometimes women act out his crazed view of the world. I mean, that's what's profoundly scary.
Sure is.
Yeah, sure is. Boy, how about those Tigers?
Peter?
I know, it's also grim. I mean, if that's all
it
we have, let's see, Lorna from Pontiac says, thank you for addressing the women. Yeah.
Every time.
Lorna, we even like to have women call. I mean,
well, and I think you should.
Once in a while.
I always encourage my sisters to call this talk show, and we will always talk about women's rights on this talk
Before show. Jalene was the co-host here, and it was just me and the guys, and we'd just say, so I goes, then he goes.
Peter, I brought this show to a new level
of reflection,
of insanity.
Yeah. Well, here's my concern about the election. People are going to say, well, you're such a big Obama supporter. Actually, I'm not a big Obama supporter. Yeah. And I don't do that to, like, back away from him or anything. I think there's been...
Because you're voting for him.
Yeah, I am going to vote for him. Although, well, yes, I am going to vote for him. And the although was that I depends if there would be, like, this huge lead for Obama in Michigan. That's when people would vote, like, for the Greens, if you're on the left, or something like that.
Jill Stein,
thank you, for the candidate from the Green Party, which has a platform and a program that would make so much sense for this country, so much more so than the Democrats. And the Republicans, they are, you know, it's like...
They're in right field.
Here's my concern with this election. I mean, I'm taking it for granted that Obama's going to win Michigan.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but no problem. So why are we even bothering to talk about this? The concern is that there are some among us, some of you listening, that are probably going to vote for Romney. Either you're disappointed in Obama, you think, gee, this guy couldn't fix everything, so I'm going to try the other party, or... I'd say it. I know it'll admit it. Racism.
There is that.
Yeah.
It is alive. We know
a couple people that say they would never vote for any candidate that supports abortion, for instance.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like that. But the concern is that Romney, well, let me put it this way in the simplest terms. Electing Romney would be like re-electing Bush.
It would absolutely be like that, but I don't know, just a different level of dumb.
But a second, a third term for Bush, imagine this. This is the guy that cut the taxes on the wealthy, started two unfunded wars, a unfunded drug program, and created this massive deficit out of what was a surplus.
Yeah, Clinton had it going on there.
And Ryan's budget, you know, Romney has nothing. He gives new meaning to the phrase empty suit.
He really is,
Peter. The Ryan budget would call for a 20% tax cut across the board. And you go, wait a minute. Maybe some people are thinking, wow, I get 20%, have to pay 20% less taxes? That's wonderful. Well, it would be. And I think everybody in the middle class, people making below, say, like $250,000, should get that. And then we can make that up. I remember I've said any number of times, no one will treat this, neither Romney or Obama.
50,000?
Cut the military budget in half. Like Ron Paul says, you bring all the bases out home. You know, why are we supporting
are we in these countries?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let's
Why are we in Germany?
Can we take our bases out of Norway, please?
Norway. Why are we in Norway?
I don't know.
Oh, my God. You know, and I know people who, in fact, someone who I know is listening right now, you know who you are, who is all Romney. Used to be a big, big, big believer in our show and what we believe in. Now is all Romney. This person doesn't have a pot to piss in. And is voting for Romney because of fiscal reasons.
Yeah, that's the most insane. You gotta realize.
Did you hear that? You know who you are.
Yeah,
Peter said it.
There is the perspective, the economic perspective, and I hope this means something to people. It's called supply side economics, and that means that the job creators, you know, those are the guys with all the money that eventually employ all us peasants on Maggie's farm, right?
Mm-hmm.
For you, those of you who remember Dylan, Bob Dylan.
Who's coming to concert?
Who's coming in concert, yeah. And he doesn't have any voice at all. But
no one cares because he's Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Where was it?
I went again.
Right. Supply-side economics. So the more money that the ultra wealthy have, the more they will invest in their industries and in their businesses and what have you, and they will then provide jobs, because it stands to reason if they have more surplus cash, they will then invest it in job creation. There'll be economic growth. We can begin to pay down the debt. Oh yeah, and we got to get all that 47% off of the dole, as call it now.
Oh yeah, off of the teat.
Yeah, right. However, that's exactly what Bush did. He gave this massive tax cut to the ultra wealthy. And where did we wind up? And remember, too, combined with that is the Bush, Reaganomics, Bush philosophy that you got to take the regulations off of the businesses.
Yeah.
Because that really hurts. Well, we saw what happened, right?
Yes, we did.
Yeah, this economic collapse that was only saved by this bailout of the banks. As odious as that it was, Paul Ryan voted for every one of those because it was initially a Bush program. And did he vote?
And people still forget that.
Yeah. Now, the Koch brothers, they're these multi-billionaire brothers who are in the top 10 richest people in the country.
Big supporters of the Tea Party.
Big, in fact.
I mean, the backers.
Yeah, the financiers. Without the Koch brothers, and that's, the Koch brothers sounds like a dope ring or something,
yeah,
doesn't it?
It's K-O-C-H.
Yeah, yeah.
They are a couple of dopes. It is a dope ring.
Yeah. And in October 1st, let's see, which of them was it? Well, it was Koch Industries President Dave Robertson, implicitly warning that many of our more than 50,000 U.S. employees and contractors may suffer the consequences of voting for President Obama and other Democrats in the 2012. And then they sent a list of conservative candidates the company's Political Action Committee endorses and a pair of editorials, one by David Koch supporting Mitt Romney, the other by Charles Koch condemning Obama. Well,
tag team.
The only thing that these guys care about is increasing their profits and the profitability of their companies. This is George Bush economics. This is the George Bush model. It failed completely. How do we know that it failed? Well, I mean, there was kind of this recession that we're still not out of.
Except for the Koch brothers. I mean, these are the cats who don't suffer at all.
Right. I was going to say, by the way, the recession is over. You might not know it in your neighborhood. You might not know it at your workplace or your ex-workplace.
Or if you're even employed, if you're lucky enough to have a job.
But with the stock market, that's what it's all about. And that's where all the excess and surplus wealth went. It didn't go into job creation at all. It went into the stock market and fueled this mad trading that went on. And that's why every one of those guys that in the top Fortune 400, the 10 top guys, including the Koch brothers, that's where they made all their money, investments. And it's all on paper. Now, of course, it's all just digital.
Yeah.
It's not real money. And these guys don't care anything about your neighborhood or you. And for you to vote for them, I mean, I'm going to get really nasty. You're a chump. And they know it.
They're pathetic.
They laugh because, you know, when they get together, you know what they talk about?
Yeah, we got them.
Just what Romney said.
People.
You 47%. You losers. You loafers.
Yeah.
You know, you bloodsuckers off the real Americans, the people that go to Cranbrook. Although I shouldn't say that because I know four guys that teach there. And there's a lot of good kids there, too.
And the reason that Peter's saying that is because a lot of people don't know.
That's where George, Mitt Romney
went to school there.
Yeah. And
school.
Yeah. There was just the thing about bullying, by the way.
Yeah. And while he was there, he did some bullying of his own. And actually, he and his buddies held a guy down and cut his hair off.
In the early 60s or something.
Yeah.
And every one of those guys in Romney's gang said that they felt horrible that they'd ever done this. Mitt Romney said, I don't remember the incident.
Of course he doesn't.
I almost said it.
These guys are
BS. Of course he remembers it.
He does.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't believe, like, really anything that comes out of that man's mouth.
All right. So my concern is not so much electing. Oh, let me just finish with George Bush. So voting for Mitt Romney, thank you.
Because they are one and the same.
Yeah. Mitt Romney is like reelecting George Bush. George Bush was such a failure of a presidency, you may notice that not only was he not mentioned at the Republican convention, they never even brought him out. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, look at the reception that Bill Clinton got at the Democratic Party convention.
Oh, yeah.
Bush? No, where's Papa Bush? Didn't bring him out.
No one. Knew
they
was
talked
even
about
there.
Reagan. One
That's
of the
all
worst
they had,
America's worst presidents
ever.
He one of the most corrupt. Actually, there've been so many corrupt ones, but he was right up there with a major corrupt administration.
He sure had, and still
but Bush,
has
where's Bush? You want Bush again? You want another war? You want to be sitting here with me announcing there'll be a demonstration against the Romney war against Venezuela or some country in Africa that we've invaded? You want another Afghanistan? You want another Iraq based on lies? And how many of you? When it turns out that whatever Venezuela did or Gambia or Ceylon, Sri Lanka or wherever, they decide they're going to, plant the flag and set up their lawn chairs,
Invade, attack.
Yeah. And I'm going to say, this is all lies. This is making this up. And you're going to be looking at the television and seeing all those, guys with these charts showing, the troop movement, like that. And then we're going to go on another 10 years and there'll be all Dick Cheney's company reaping in the billions. You got to remember this whole time that the United States was sinking deeper and deeper into debt and the recession was being prepared for by Reaganomics and Bush's economic policies, that all of these Republican industries were just reaping in the billions, our tax dollars. Nothing for your schools, nothing to create jobs
or infrastructure,
jobs or anything like that. It was going to their buddies.
Let alone to protect the environment.
And if you can't stand to vote for Obama, at least don't be dumb enough to vote for Mitt Romney. Stay home. Think about the Tigers and the...
Yeah, just go back to sports and reality television.
Yeah.
Oh, and I was back on the note about contractors. Remember a little company called Halliburton?
Yeah. Dick Cheney's little group. At least the economy has gotten much better for those at the top. Talk a little about that. Also, any concerns you have when we come back. I was going to give the phone number, but hey, we employ somebody to do that. Talk about jobs.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jolene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
Liz.
Todd?
I want you back.
You're just saying that because I got a makeover to make me look hot, even though I was hot to begin with.
No. I miss those nights instantly watching TV episodes and movies online with Netflix.
We watched as much as we wanted.
Whenever and wherever we wanted.
So, you love me? Even if I put these glasses back on?
Wow, those are thick.
Instantly watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on all kinds of devices for only $8 a month with Netflix. Start your free trial today. See terms of use.
No matter how much our kids amaze us, they can't run for Michigan Supreme Court this year. That's why they need judges who stand up for them.
Michigan Supreme Court candidates Judge Connie Kelly, Judge Sheila Johnson, and family advocate Bridget McCormick have spent their careers protecting families and victims of crime.
From getting criminals off our streets to keeping kids out of gangs, Kelly, Johnson, and McCormick are keeping families safer.
As mothers and advocates for children, Connie Kelly, Sheila Johnson, and Bridget McCormick have zero tolerance for violence against women and kids.
Unlike current Michigan Supreme Court justices who suggest sexual harassment is protected as free speech and ruled corporations have no responsibility to prevent workplace assault or even rape, Kelly, Johnson, and McCormick take violence against women seriously.
Supreme Court candidates Judge Connie Kelly, Judge Sheila Johnson, and family advocate Bridget McCormick.
These three protect families.
Paid for by the Michigan Democratic State Central Committee, not authorized by any candidate committee.
Mike Rowe here at a Ford dealer with a little Q&A for Fiona. According to the signs, Ford is having some sort of big tire event. How would you describe the event?
It's big.
The savings one might enjoy at the event.
They're big.
What about the selection?
Big.
Get a $60 mail-in rebate on four select tires. Use the Ford Service credit card for an additional $60. Click on the banner ad.
So I think we can agree then that Ford's tire vent is good sized.
No, Michael. It's big.
Subject to credit approval. Rebate by check. Offer cannot be combined. See participating Ford dealer for rebate details by 11/30/12.
My attempt, good intentions.
WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. We're talking about
the election.
Yeah, you're going to watch, not you, I meant the audience.
Right.
Are you going to watch the debate? I'm not. I'm not at all. Not even going to. This one on Tuesday. I'm going to play handball like I always do. Anyway, bonus up, let us know what you're thinking and something. Oh, yeah, I said I was going to talk about how good Wall Street is doing, but let me put that on hold just for a minute. Let me tell you, while unemployment is high, they are doing terrific on Wall Street. What's up here? I mean, and Romney, What do you think? He's going to cut into their deal? I don't know that Obama will, but I know for sure Romney won't. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that's I wanted to say.
And we're going to get to your phone calls in just a minute. Yeah. So hang on the line.
On all the greater media stations in Detroit, with now the interviews that I do at 1 a.m. on WRIF are going to play on the other stations as well, all at 6 a.m. on the HD sub-channels. You can get those online, although eventually everybody will have an HD radio. Still,
I have one.
You do? Hardly yeah. anybody has one, which I don't understand what at all, because it's got great sound quality.
Yeah.
HD radio is to FM that FM was to AM years ago or something like that. And, this is, I keep thinking, what
focus,
is going
Peter.
Through focus? I can't.
Come on.
I can't.
Come back to
me. I can't do it. I never could. In fact, we should just talk about this. Attention disorder or not, pills to help in school. I wanted
That's
to get into that a little
mm-hmm.
while. But, what I wanted to talk about was that at 1 a.m., and this is a little while from now, I'm going to be having a couple guests, and both of them are keynote speakers. Now, no yawns on the annual North American Labor History Conference.
Well, and that is one of the ringing subjects right now, which is collective bargaining and unions.
Yeah, but still, I bet you a seemingly academic conference about labor history, it's kind of boring on the face of it.
I think it sounds cool, but
I'm a nerd like that. My friend, Fran Shore, a professor at Wayne State University in the history department, has put this together, and it's going to be really rocking.
It really
for
is.
Sure. I mean, it's not going to be stand-up comedy. It's not going to be – if you like this show, if you can listen to me, these folks down at Wayne State, which is going to be on the this coming Thursday, the 18th through Saturday, the 20th, is going to be pretty good. And so a couple of the people that I have at 1 a.m., Gerald Horn, who is a historian, and also another, let me see what's her name, Heather Ann Thompson, is going to talk about Detroit.
Cool.
So, and what's the effect?
We need to talk about Detroit.
Yeah, what's the effect of mass incarceration? You know, they have something now called million-dollar blocks. In poor areas where there is such a high rate of incarceration, it costs governments literally $1 million per block to deal with this mass incarceration. And of course, great numbers of the people, maybe even the majority of people in the American prison system, the highest inmate count in the world, percentage-wise and absolute number, is from the failed, we always say the failed drug war. It hasn't failed because it's another one of these great wealth transfers. It takes our tax dollars, and rather than building, as Jolene was saying, infrastructure, getting class size down to 15 kids, you're fixing the road and where you travel on every day, anything you can think of that we need in this country. Instead, it goes to the
healthcare.
Yeah, healthcare could go to, but to the prison industrial complex that it needs.
They got to fill those jails.
Yeah, so they need the drug laws to get the clients for all of that. Anyway.
So, 1 a.m., the interviews.
Yeah.
Now where are you going?
Okay. I want to go also that on Saturday. One of the things, too, is a lot of you are pretty isolated. You say, I'm the only one around here that
feels this way.
Nobody does anything.
My whole family's full of right-wingers.
Yeah. Come to events like this. There's another one. We've had this man on our show any number of times. David Rovics. He's a singer-songwriter. He's really like a movement, a social movement troubadour. He sings topical songs, and he is going to be at this wonderful facility, Cass City Cinema, down around Peterborough and Cass, in this old school that the proprietor, Joel Landy, has completely refurbished with. It's a theater,
movie theater. It's really cool.
Digital projection with great Dolby sound. But David Rovics is going to be there on Saturday night, the 20th. And start coming to things like this if you want to get involved. If you just want to kind of lay back and once in a while think a show like this is kind of cool, that's okay. You know, what you're thinking is good, too. But it's really good to be around people that think the same way you do and hear songs sung that reflect the kind of views that you might have. Unfortunately, this is all on the left. So if you're on the right, you can listen to Sean Hannity and I don't know what, Lawrence Welk or whatever.
Trying to think of who the righties.
There's some right wing.
Well, let's just go to country music.
Yeah,
Toby
yeah.
Keith.
Yeah, right, those guys.
Yeah, rock but, out, have
so,
fun.
If I'm presenting this in a fairly confusing way, go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, or to our website, I'm sorry, our Facebook page at facebook.com/nightcall. Shoo.
Right. You got it all out, Peter. Let someone else talk.
Stick with me, folks. Here is Chuck. Chuck's in Auburn Hills. Hey, Chuck, you're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for being our first caller.
Peter, you're the only person I listen to. When I listen to you, I feel like my head's going to explode.
Well, mine too. You know, there's an old... we mentioned Bob Dylan. He has a line. He said, I got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about that birth control, but you were talking about that election. I don't know that Romney says he forgot that he did that stuff. I don't think that he did forget it. I think he'd done so much stuff like that that he really doesn't remember that.
You know, you sound interestingly a lot like Mike from Fenton.
Really?
Yeah. No?
No.
Okay. Peter, you're so suspect. Come on.
Okay. Sorry, Chuck.
But look, this birth control thing, One more thing I wanted to say about that election real quick was that Obama, you know, I seen him and his wife a few days ago. There's no way that Obama is the president. That woman is running everything. There's no question about it. And you know what? That's a good
woman.
That's a good thing.
Obama. Michelle. That woman is awesome. President Obama ain't got nothing on her. That woman is something else.
Well, I agree.
I think she's a righteous woman.
You know, and you know how guys are when they look at women. But I told you, when she was talking at the Democratic convention, I just kept looking at her arms, which was...
Well, that's what everyone talks about.
Her arms, do they?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's a first for
me. Her guns.
Her what?
Her guns.
Guns?
That's another term for...
Arms?
Arms.
Really? Never heard that.
Yeah.
All right, Mike. I mean, Chuck. Thanks a lot.
you are so ornery.
Here's John in Detroit. Hi, John. You're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead.
Yeah, I really enjoy your show, and I'm a veteran. I served in the United States Army's 9th Infantry Division, 1972 to 1974.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see Obama and Joe Biden point out and bring to light to the public the utter hypocrisy, the deplorable hypocrisy of Romney and his fellow travelers on the right, Limbaugh, Hannity, O'Reilly. Romney's record in Massachusetts was one of cutting veterans' benefits. The Republican Congress has not passed a vet's jobs bill. Obama has done as much as he possibly can with this Congress for funding for vets and vets programs. Romney is an individual who purposely went out of his way not to serve in Vietnam, and I don't have a problem with that.
Well,
but he's a guy who said he professed and had a belief and protested in favor of the war.
Yeah, I was going to say that there was that now on the internet there are photographs of him protesting the protesters, right? Have you seen those? Yeah.
Yes, I have seen it, and that's even worse because he had the opportunity to go over there before he went to France, and when he came back from France. And now you have him and his sons that don't want to go serve any wars. And
Now, John, he said he had a perfectly good reason why his sons were not serving in Iraq or in Afghanistan, and that was because they were helping him with his campaign, and that's good for America.
Oh, God.
Well, I didn't hear that one, but that all makes sense.
No, that's what he said. And doesn't Biden have a son?
Yes, Joe Biden's son did serve in Iraq, and I think he did two tours.
Yeah.
And which is two more tours than vice presidential candidate, who seems to be for every war that there ever comes down the track, but doesn't want to help the vets when they get back.
Well, you know, John, there was, and I don't think it's as relevant anymore, but I think in general it is, there was a website called Chicken Hawks, and this was all the Republicans. This is very odd, because somehow the Republicans are thought to be the big supporters of the military and, you know, for peace through strength and all that. And all the Democrats at a particular time were all veterans of that era in which you served, many of them having served in Vietnam, like John Kerry and what have you. And every Republican to a man had scammed out of the draft one way or another. Yeah, you know, remember George Bush. I mean, he, his rich daddy got him, you know, out of the draft and into the Texas Air National Guard.
Which
and,
then he skipped.
Yeah. He was even AWOL for a while. So those guys are just a fraud of the first magnitude.
Yeah, they're not only frauds, but they're very hypocritical. And I am aware of the whole
that too.
Chicken hawk phenomena, because I met quite a few of them when I did get out of the Army, and I've met quite a few of them since. So,
hey, well, John, let me ask you a question. When you were in Vietnam and you knew all these protests were going on, what were your thoughts about it?
Well, I wasn't actually in Vietnam. I served as Vietnam was ending and it was being turned over to the South Vietnamese troops.
Okay.
But I served in the 9th Infantry Division from 72 to 74.
Oh, I got
so,
you.
I did, as I stated, I met quite a few of these people afterwards when I got out of the Army that didn't have any compunction whatsoever sending other people in harm's way, and they're still out on the trail and out in the political campaigns.
Gotcha. All right, John, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Yeah. Romney doesn't do real good on vets. Hey, I wanted to bring this up, your thoughts as well at 313-298-WRIF. For the first time since researchers began tracking the religious identity of Americans, fewer than half said they were Protestants, which is a steep decline from 40 years ago when Protestant churches claimed the loyalty of more than two-thirds of the population.
Wow.
So it's dropping. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life put this together and said it's not liberal mainstream Protestants like Methodists or Episcopalians who have abandoned their faith, but more conservative evangelical and born-agains are dropping out as well. The losses were among white Protestants, but not among black or minority Protestants, that the study showed. When they leave, instead of switching churches, they join the growing ranks of those who do not identify with any religion. Nearly one in five Americans say they are atheist, agnostic, or, quote, nothing in particular. This is a significant jump from only 5 years ago when adults who claimed no religion made up about 15% of the population. And the article says it is a seismic shift from 40 years ago when 7% of American adults said they had no religious affiliation. So what now? It's up to 20%. Now more than one-third of those ages 18 to 22, are religiously unaffiliated. And I think there's really a lot more. I mean, I've said this a lot of times before, that a lot of people's religious beliefs are, a mile wide and an inch deep. I mean, if you go up to somebody and you say, do you believe in God? And they go, huh? Yeah. And sometimes, sometimes, you know, you can say to them, do you think the Bible is the literal word of God? Yeah. And, I never thought of it, but they can't even imagine what the no implies.
I know so few people who go to church. So few. My entire family does, but I...
Well, I said, I know the people that I know that are religious, the only people I know who are religious are the people that are really involved in the peace and social justice movement.
Yes, the ones we march side by side
with. Yeah, and mostly Catholics. So the Catholics, man, they're just disappearing almost. But one of the what happened, let's see, it says this is a significant jump from only 5 years ago. 5 years ago, what happened? What was 5 years ago? Oh, yeah, it was the end of the Bush administration. Now, you can say, what could that possibly have to do with it? Well, you know, it's getting more and more embarrassing to be religious because people, and I probably unfairly, maybe not so unfairly, when you say, oh, yes, I'm a very devout Christian or something like that, people go, you know, right-wing religious nut, right? And, in fact, somebody wrote me, a listener, and said they really liked this program, but they disliked it when I was critical of Catholics. And I said, for one thing...
Wait, this was at the old network?
No.
Remember that?
We
got in trouble for going after the Catholic Church when we were syndicated nationally.
Oh, yeah, and our employer was a devout Catholic.
We were in trouble that
Too
day.
Too bad. You were texting me. You sure you want to go there? Is that the day I got fired?
No.
It was the day after.
I don't know because I was in Puerto Rico the day we got fired.
No. Okay.
I didn't even know till I came back to the States.
Anyway, so I wrote the listener and I said, look, usually when I start talking about religion, I always give the caveat that some of the best people I know are religious to the point. where if someone said empirically, if the only thing you knew about religion were the people you knew in your own life, I'd think, well, it doesn't seem to make much sense to think there's an invisible man and all this stuff that they have, mm-hmm. but these people sure are some good people.
Absolutely.
Right. Now, and I was thinking of, how about this? The nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not
okay.
the N-U-N-S.
Because yeah. we know some radical nuns, too.
Yeah, we do. The nuns, as they are called, now make up the nation's second largest religious grouping.
Oh, you mean the people who have no religion in their lives or don't believe in anything?
They are called nuns, N-O-N-E-S.
Okay.
The largest single faith group is Catholics, who make up about 22%, and then the nuns.
Really?
Us, 20%.
We count.
And their numbers, our numbers have held, Catholic numbers have held steady, mostly because of an influx of immigrants has replaced the many Catholics who were raised in the church and have left in the last 5 years.
Yeah, a lot of Catholics in the Hispanic community.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to be a Catholic and then, read what goes on in every aspect of the church from the papacy down to, the locals. Phil Zuckerman, a professor of sociology who did the study, said the significant majority of the religious unaffiliated tend to be left-leaning, tend to support the Democratic Party, support gay marriage and environmental causes. That's the religiously unaffiliated, but huge numbers of the religiously affiliated, African-American, Latino, people like that, mm-hmm. a lot of people from immigrants from Latin America who are devoutly religious as a group are also left-leaning, do not support gay marriage, and, I don't know, they support environmental causes. Pardon me. The Pew Report offers several theories to explain the rise of the religiously unaffiliated. One theory is that the young adults grew up disillusioned with organized religion when evangelical Protestant and Catholic churches became so active in conservative political causes, like opposition to homosexuality and abortion. And I think it's not even so much, I think there is greater support among young people for marriage equality.
Absolutely.
And for a woman's right to choose. But even if they don't, it is certainly a ethos among young people is, hey, I don't get in your face.
Yeah.
You don't get in mine.
Yeah. What you want to do in your bedroom is your business.
Even if I don't agree with it, they might say.
Right.
I'm just not going to go.
Because it really is none of their business.
There also is a worldwide trend towards secularization that is in most of the economically developed countries like Australia and Canada and most of them in Europe as well. And let's see, even among Americans who claim no religion, few qualified as purely secular. Two-thirds say they still believe in God and one-fifth say they pray every day. Only 12% of the religiously unaffiliated group said they were atheists and 17% agnostic.
Interesting.
All right, we're going to take a break. Right back to get your calls.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Ever hear somebody say, we can do this the easy way, or we can do it the hard way? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At GEICO.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you can save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bill online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit GEICO.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
Hey, dog, where's your owner?
Watching Netflix.
Yeah?
He can instantly watch as many TV episodes and movies as he wants online.
Well, I know what you did on my lawn, and it's not funny.
It is to kids.
Well, what are their parents supposed to laugh at?
The sophisticated jokes. Like, that dog chasing his tail reminds me of politicians.
Instantly watch as many TV episodes and movies as your family wants on all kinds of devices for only $8 a month with Netflix. Start your free trial today. See terms of use.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Your final chance to fly off for WRIF's Sin City Takeover 2012 is happening today. Listen and win from the Riff. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Hi, welcome back to our second hour at 1 a.m. Remember, a couple of interesting interviews, people that will be at The North American Labor History Conference at Wayne State University. Everyone's invited. A lot of these keynote speakers, by the way, are free to the public. There's a slight registration fee if you want to see the whole thing. I'll be down there for a lot of it, and cool. You can find out about it. And this is a way to start hooking in to people that are trying to make some sense of the world, trying to make some resistance to the 1%. So you don't have to do this all by yourself. You're just sitting there looking at the television and screaming it or doing something online. And also Friday night, there is a cultural event with some good music and some spoken word. And I actually don't have the program right in front of me. David Rovix, who is also going to be the singer-songwriter, movement, peace and social justice movement, troubadour, is going to be singing on Saturday night, but he'll also be playing a bit on Friday night as well. If that's not enough detail, go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, or our Facebook page, Facebook.com/nightcall.
Speaking of music, we were talking about right-wing musicians, and we got an email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, which is our show email, from Dave in Livonia. Love the show, guys. Just so you know, aside from Lawrence Welk, Dave Mustaine from Megadeth, and our hometown boy Kid Rock are both supporters of Romney. It's not just
nut- And so is Ted Nugent.
Well, that's where I was going. He said, it's not just Nutball Nugent. And he says he loves listening to us every week. Great show. Thanks, Dave. We appreciate you listening.
What is, let me see.
Peter.
Oh, yeah. Are we on the air?
Flow of show.
I was just looking at all of these. This one from Harold, where he was talking to, I'm not going to name all these people.
Don't name any of them.
No, I'm not. Great show, and I'm enjoying myself thoroughly. I think the right-wing hosts you are talking about are, and then he names
them all.
Yeah.
He sure knows who they are.
Well, you know, now there are three right-wing stations in Detroit.
And they're split.
Well, they're killing each other because they're all splitting the audience of these, you know, middle-aged, angry white guys.
That's true.
Good. So
anyway, he says we're more entertaining than all of them. Well, thank you, Harold.
Yeah.
Because these guys, well, they're just empty.
Yeah. How about this one from Luis? Let me see if I can get it to open. And I've seen this on the internet.
This is scary.
Yeah, there's a guy with a Romney sticker on his back, and on the back of his T-shirt it says, put the white back in the White House.
Yeah, see, this is exactly what I'm talking about. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
Racist pigs.
And you would think, well, I don't know, I guess everybody has a right to say even the most stupid, vile things that have a history laced with murderous mob activity.
God.
But why are those guys all supporting Romney?
And anyone, think about that one. And anyone who would have the nerve to put that shirt on and actually wear it. It's one thing to be a racist and think it, but then to say it, and then to wear it on a shirt. These people are disgusting. Let me tell you how I really feel.
Well, you know, that's just how it's affecting you. You're disgusted by it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so am I. But think about the brain of those people. I mean, so filled with anger, filled with hatred. You know,
are you having compassion?
A good Buddhist, has compassion because they move. Buddha nature is this perfect being. And when we commit acts that move us away from our Buddha nature, mm-hmm. we're less of a person.
It's
right?
true. But you know what?
F them. Yeah, that's what I say. But
see you later, MF.
Yeah. All right, we were talking before the break. Anybody want to comment on this? 313-298-WRIF. How the percentage of Protestants in America is in a steep decline, and the rise of people who claim no religion is going up and up to now. It's about 20% of the population.
I mean, we talked about how, you know, who we have in our lives and when it comes to religion and all of that. I'm curious what other people in the audience are seeing around them, because I know a lot of people I talk to say, I don't really know anyone who's into God.
But. And we're called nuns, N-O-N-E-S. I like that.
The atheist category.
Yeah, and I wonder, well, there's people that don't have any religious affiliation. Some of them still say they believe in God, although they don't want to be affiliated
with organized religion.
Yeah, but you're supposed to be able to be part of the process, or what's the diff, depends on what you believe. But anyway, was wondering, within the gay community, there's a lot of stuff about coming out.
Yeah.
And so come out to your family.
Coming out day the other day.
Yeah, coming out to your friends. So I wonder whether any of you have had experience where you finally had to tell somebody in your life that you no longer wanted to be part of a religion, or even worse, Gaia forbid. Gaia's what?
Pagan goddess.
Pagan goddess of nature, yeah. Gaia forbid that you had to tell someone that you were now an atheist.
No, I know. Well, I did that with my family. And, you know, this is the thing. My family found God, okay? They go to this big...
Mega church,
Lutheran in Iowa.
Yeah.
And I got to be honest, most of them, they just are kind of better people. I mean, they're not.
Oh, I thought you were going to say.
They treat me better. I'm telling you. And even though I tell them, you know, that they know that I'm an atheist, I don't belittle them or, you know, I talk about them on this talk show because they're all right-wingers. They wouldn't listen to this show. But I feel like it has improved their lives. I think it can improve. I think some people kind of need that sense of structure and false hope of the sky gods.
Yeah. I think, I mean, there's different ways to, if I was ever going to become spiritual, I think there would be other ways I would go before.
Buddhism, paganism.
Yeah, something like that. And we were talking about one of the reasons people are moving away from religion is that these right-wingers that are so prevalent in the Republican Party and have gotten so much power in the United States that you say, why? Hey, I'm a devout Christian. And people go, oh, are you like the Arkansas state representative that said if slavery was so god-awful, why didn't Jesus or Paul condemn it?
He really said it.
Yeah.
He really said that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, my God. What is it with the South?
Yeah, he says, if slavery were so god-awful, why didn't Jesus or Paul condemn it? Why was it in the Constitution, and why wasn't there a war before 1861? The last part of it makes no sense whatsoever. But let's go back to his question. Why was it in the Constitution? If you listen, I think I'm going to have that on at 1:30, that historian Gerald Horn will speak exactly to that question, why slavery was enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, and in fact, why even so many of these colonists wanted to separate from England. I mean, actually, I'll give it away. They were afraid that England was going to abolish slavery because it had been a legal decision in England, I think in the 1760s, that held that it was, you know what? I don't want to just guess at that. It's called the Somerset decision, not like the Somerset collection. Or maybe it is. S-O-M-E-R-S-E-T?
Is that which is this very fancy.
Oh, okay. Well, that's also the Somerset. Someone Google it or something like that. Or John or Calvin, check it out and tell me what that is. But so a lot of people just don't want to be, associated with all this. There's another thing. There's an anti-bullying day coming up on October 30th, right? And, that used to be taken for granted. I was bullied
People beat each other up on the playground
all
the time.
Yeah, and
right?
I was bullied.
But this is different.
Yeah, there was this big bully that around our, it wasn't because I was this little weakling.
I was actually bullied once, too, by boys in high school.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, this was in high school. There was like these big, tough gangs, and this guy would come up to us, and we would actually we had change, and he'd always shake us down. We put our money in our mouth.
What?
Say, we don't have any. The guy said, what? We don't have any. Right.
But, are you serious?
Yeah. And this guy was, this guy became a mobster and was actually murdered. And found out in the assassinated, actually, killed by the mob. Found, and we said, hey,
Peter,
paybacks are MFs.
Oh, yes, they are.
Yeah. We didn't do it. We didn't do it, though. They have something called Mix It Up at Lunch Day. Did you know that?
No.
On October 30th, about 2,500 schools are involved in this program. Organized
by... Is this in Michigan or what?
No, this is all over the country. It's organized by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Really tracks right-wing extremists and what have you. But the American Family Association, this conservative evangelical group, and this goes back to when, if you say, well, I'm a devout Christian, people think, Anyway, they say that this anti-bullying day is a nationwide push to promote the homosexual lifestyle in public school. And that's a giveaway. If someone says...
If they say homosexual.
Homosexual, because that's when they used to call people... When they themselves used to call people homos.
Right.
You homo.
Yeah.
Gee, you really don't hurt a guy. Oh. Don't you? Yeah. So now what they're trying to do is they're trying to destroy this Mix It Up Day. And Maureen Costello, the director of the Poverty Center's Teaching Tolerance Project, which organizes the program, says, I was surprised that they completely lied about what Mix It Up Day is. And Brian Fisher, who is the director of this Christian association, says, we tell the truth about homosexual behavior.
My God!
Yeah. He says anti-bullying legislation is another thinly veiled attempt to promote the homosexual agenda.
I mean, are these people so... They are terrified.
Yeah, of what?
They really are. They're terrified of homosexuality.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you got to think... I always say it. They've got a little bit of an issue going on in their own brains because maybe they have a little bit of tingling in their legs when they think about it.
No one is in favor of, he says, the right-winger, of anyone getting bullied for any reason, but these anti-bullying policies become a mechanism for punishing Christian students who believe that the homosexual behavior is not something that should be normalized.
What is it? Because it is normal. Sorry.
Well, I don't know whether it's normal. It's natural.
Well, it's natural. That's what
I mean.
You
know why it's natural? Because people do it.
People do it.
Yeah.
10% of the population is doing it.
As we speak.
Or more. Right now. They're doing it. Think about it.
That's only the homosexuals that are currently up.
Right.
There's another 10 or 15%.
You mean awake.
Yeah, awake.
Not up.
Yeah, right. The other 10 or 15% are sleeping. So it's a lot more than Let's see. The program is not about sexual orientation at all, but rather about breaking up social cliques, which are especially evident in a school cafeteria. And in some schools, cliques are socioeconomic.
Cliques. But do you say cliques?
What do you say, cliques?
Yes.
That's what you said when you were in high school.
Here you go again.
It's clique. Yeah. I'm not in their clique. I mean, that's, yeah, it's clique. Is.
No, it's not.
All right. Can I get a witness? Anyone? We'll look it up. In others, they are ethnic or religious or based on sexual orientation. By giving students a way to mix with other students on this particular day, self-imposed social barriers can be broken down and bullying can be curbed. But the idea that the program is intended as a homosexual indoctrination is simply wrong, Ms. Costello added.
Stretching.
Yeah. We've become used to the idea of lunatic fringe attacks, but this one was completely misrepresentation. So that's what I think is driving people away from religion. You know, it's like, what are they, Gresham's law of currency, bad money drives out good?
Well, yeah, and they're just making the whole institution look bad, these people.
Yeah, they are. All right, let's
take a phone call.
God.
Let's do it, Peter.
You don't want one.
Go on.
Here's Gary. Gary's in Plymouth. Go ahead, Gary. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm just stating a fact that I keep watching the television and I don't see anybody in Romney's circle, as far as people are concerned, that are black.
Yeah, that's true.
Is he a racist or is he out there going to defend America and say we're going to split this country up because of human rights? And it's very... politically unclear for me to look at this and say it's right. It's wrong because there's nobody on his panel yet. I don't even think he's on his panel. I see no black.
Well, you know, birds of a feather flock together. And so these angry white men all kind of move
too.
In packs.
Yeah.
And, you know, surprisingly enough, because they are crafty, right, Peter, these politicians. Surprisingly, he hasn't gotten his token black person in there, right?
What was that guy? Where's the 999 guy? They're probably keeping him away. What was his name? I always forget his name.
Herman Cain,
999.
What happened to him? Wait, he's raking in millions, probably on speaking tours.
Yeah, but all these women are suing him that he sexually harassed.
Oh,
so
what a slime ball.
Well, I don't know. It is when you think about even white candidates like John Kerry. They got like 20% in some of these southern states. So it is completely 100% race. And these people are blinded by race. And as I always say, if you can't think straight about race, you can't think straight about anything else. Yeah. But good point. Thanks for bringing it up. Let's see here. Mix It Up Day is October 30th. Gary may be. Never mind. Okay. Got it.
Hey,
thanks, Gary.
Okay. I, you know, when Obama started campaigning and all the racism started occurring and coming out of the race is coming out of the woodwork, right?
Yeah.
And then I just can't believe the levels it's gone to. I never even thought that it would get to this point. I mean, it's really sick.
It is. Well, for one thing, I don't contend, neither does Jolene, that everyone that supports Romney is a racist.
Not at all.
But all the racists support Romney.
Yeah, so true.
And people have been writing that they are becoming less and less of a factor in American politics, particularly as the generations change and young people aren't infected by the virus of racism
right.
as much as past generations mm-hmm. were. And you think about that, you know, we always celebrate this Martin Luther King March on Washington mm-hmm. 50 years ago, 1963?
And we do it downtown Detroit.
Yeah, yeah. That at that time, that march was supported by 23% of the people.
That's it?
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah, so you get an idea.
And now it's just this monumental, yeah. the speech and the whole march, everything.
And I think particularly young people probably think, why are all these old people always talking about race? What is up with that?
Yeah, what's their problem? Because it just doesn't matter.
Yeah. All right. Here, Maurice is in Detroit. Maurice, how you doing?
Hello, Peter. Hello, Jolene.
Maurice, how are you?
Oh, well, I was in the seventh grade halfway through the semester. I kept on getting bullied by these two guys. One white, one black.
You were bullied?
Yeah, well, guess what happened to them one day?
What?
They pissed me off. I beat the crap out of them. I started taking their money from them, and they lunched.
Well,
did you say you beat the crap out of
him?
Yeah,
they beat the crap out of him. Well, that's always one way to deal with bullies. Thank you, Maurice.
Maybe he had something else to say.
Maybe. But he's got to get a better phone. I think he's on speakerphone all the time.
I think, well, he's driving the cab.
Maurice, you got to pull over.
And he gets, and Maurice gets very worked up about things.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah.
He has passion.
Yeah. Here's David in Detroit. David, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how are the both of you? I haven't talked to you in a while and just wanted to call and say hello.
Well, hi, David.
Hello. How are you?
Usually, I'm doing well. Just got in. But, you know, I always call and think, yeah, I've got something I want to say. And then I hear the two of you talk and then I find I want to chime into something else. But, you know, what's interesting is you were talking about, you know, race and the politics and, you know, I think you had mentioned, Jolene, the token black guy in the, Romney camp, right? And
well,
what
no,
I
he's not.
Was,
he's not there yet.
Yeah,
well, he's not there yet, right?
Yeah.
But I tell you, the one that everybody misses that I thought was just the gem of the campaign season was Vermin Supreme.
Oh yeah, would you? Vermin Supreme is a perennial presidential candidate who usually I forgot what his platform is. I've actually saw him once. He was wearing a galosh. You know what they used to call galoshes? Those kind of big rubber things that buckle up on his head.
Right.
But what?
I saw him last at CPAC. I was there for,
the
you know,
conservative.
Yeah. You know, it's basically I would go and our folks would go because we're supporting Dr. Paul and we want to inject some libertarianism into that just stale group over there.
Well, wait a minute.
Actually, we had.
Well, good. Now, wait a minute, David. We've stumbled onto something. Ron Paul just, interestingly, because he almost did he speak at the Republican convention? No. He refused. Right. I remember they wanted to have all. They said he had to announce that he endorsed them, and somewhere in all this stuff, that Ron Paul has just said there's no difference
between
Mitt and Obama, which is something that could be discussed. But I wonder what effect that will have on Libertarian and Ron Paul supporters. Who are you going to vote for, David?
Well, there's talk of Gary Johnson. And, you know, obviously, I think, Jillian, you mentioned the Green Party candidate. And there's some others, obviously. But I in good conscience, cannot vote for either one of these two. I mean, it just becomes a game of red team versus blue team at this point because, you know, we're talking about the war on women or we're talking about racism or we're talking about whatever Romney talks about, which I'm still trying to figure out. But, you know, the major issues, neither one of them are different. And
that's
it's the major
true.
Issues that aren't, but I'm saying the major issues that aren't even being discussed on the news, like the NDAA, okay, like, you know, these foreign wars and sending our troops wherever, or like sound money or like, you know, the war on the internet. I mean, nobody's talking about SOPA and CISPA.
But here's the thing. A Romney presidency is going to be far more scary than what you think an Obama presidency would be.
Even if there is a lot of similarities in terms of where they're basically, well, you know what, I wouldn't say there'd be even, you know, actually, I used to say that there was a lot of difference between the two parties, but it's been increasing. And as what I said earlier, is that the election of Mitt Romney will be like a third term for George Bush, except maybe worse.
Yeah. Well, let me answer your question, though. You asked about Dr. Paul in the future, right?
Yeah.
Of what the hell?
This is Ron Paul, folks.
Yeah, Ron Paul.
Yeah. I mean, basically, you know, we're still involved. We're, you know, he's become effective immediately the honorary chairman of Campaigns for Liberty, which I'm a part of here in Michigan, and we're going to do some legislative stuff, and we're going to stay engaged. We're going to stay involved in the party and work to take control over the state GOP, which we're probably just under 50% right now, and we're growing. And libertarianism will be back, and it, you know, it's good for everybody. It doesn't mean you agree with everything that libertarians.
I don't think it's good for everybody. I think that's kind of a big statement.
Yeah, I would. I would say.
All right.
Yeah. Let's see here. Wait, just hang on here a minute, David. Here, this is from someone who signs his email to us, Raskolnikov, the Dostoevsky character in one of the novels. Jolene mentioned earlier that a lot of people that do not have a pot to piss in were going to vote for Romney.
So eloquently put it that way.
And Raskolnikov says, that phrase calls to mind the large number of libertarians I encounter on an internet forum who vigorously defend the 1%. I'm absolutely certain none of them have a pot to piss in and probably will never pay down their credit cards. I'm not sure what that says. But no, I would say that without massive state intervention and protection, that capitalism never would have established itself and couldn't continue. In fact, unless we have a massive state presence and transfer of wealth from individuals to the government in a way that actually creates jobs rather than the military, the war on drugs, or stuff like that, that the whole system is probably going to collapse. So.
In theory, I would agree with you. The problem is that every time government gets its fingers into something, it always mucks it up, and it never spends the money wisely.
Well, I don't know. What about Social Security?
I mean,
what about Medicare?
Never. Always. You're a little over the top, and that's coming from me.
What about roads? What about first responders? What about public schools when they're halfway decently financed? That all seems
Let's
to
take roads. Let's take roads.
Okay.
All right, you've been on Michigan roads.
Yeah.
Those are taken out of tax dollars. I've been on turnpikes. I've never seen a pothole on a turnpike, and they're always immaculate.
Yeah.
I go on these publicly funded roads, and they're potholes everywhere.
Wait. You think that turnpikes are run by private individuals?
There's privately run highways, most definitely. When you pay a toll, you're paying into a privately run highway. If you're not paying a toll, it's publicly funded. It's taken out of tax dollars.
Well, it's both ways. I mean, the New York, the Thruway or Turnpike, the Mass Pike, all that stuff. I mean, you're paying a toll. I mean, rather than it all coming just out of tax dollars. But look, David, we could kind of go on endlessly with this. I don't mean to say that it doesn't have value, but let me get some other people on the air. Thank you for your call. I appreciate that. 313-298-WRIF. Some open lines for you. Nobody came out as an atheist or an agnostic to their family or their wife or their siblings or their friends. And I'd really like to hear some stories. I mean, I came from an atheist family, like third generation, you know, so that was nothing. I mean, I was surprised when I found, you know, people would say, I move into a new neighborhood and the kids would say, where are you going to church? And I'd go, church? There's no God. You know, I'm talking about like I'm 8 years old.
That's amazing.
And they go, what?
That's like telling them there's no Santa Claus.
Yeah, why do they always sound like chickens? What?
God. Yeah. Oh, man.
I mean, I used to love it. I made these kids cry. I loved it. I told you, remember, I'm not going to tell it again, that story, too, when I was a camp counselor and I made that kid cry?
Yes. You'd be so mean.
Well, I was just telling the truth.
But yeah.
Tell what I believe. Yeah. Guy, you know, don't ask me. I won't tell you. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Scott in Westland. Scott, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Pete. Hi, Jolene. Well, I want to talk about why I don't think Romney won the debate. I'm grateful to the BBC for highlighting this. The exchange that they highlighted was one where Obama raised the issue of how companies, corporations, can disassemble a factory, an entire assembly line, and ship it overseas, and then declare the expense of doing that, the expense of moving all that equipment to, say, Mexico or China, they can declare it as a deduction on their corporate income tax. And so they're basically incentivized, you know, they're rewarded for moving whole factories overseas.
So why does this mean, you know, it's all, what, like beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. So is who won. And right now it is riveted in our minds that Obama lost and this has reinvigorated the Romney campaign. So, and you know that this is not an insult, but what you're saying essentially what a wonk would say, a policy wonk, someone that really looks at facts and figures and the implications that it has for the real world, not the way it plays on the spectacle where people just nod their head and what becomes strong beliefs is something they heard 5 minutes ago on one of the cable networks, right?
Well, okay, what I would say is that, let me explain why Romney gave basically a Sarah Palin answer. Okay, okay, Obama is weak on this issue because in the first 2 years of his term, of his term as president, he had a Democratic Congress. So actually, a sharp debater might have said, okay, if those laws are still on the books back in 2009 and 2010, you had a chance to repeal them, to change the U.S. tax law. Why didn't you do it when you had the Democratic Congress? But that's not what Romney said. Romney goes into a state of denial. He goes into his experienced businessman routine and says, I've been in business for 30 years, and I've never heard of such a thing. So basically, he pleaded ignorance, that this is the United States tax code. It's in black and white.
Okay. Well, they asked him, do you think the taxes you pay, the 14% that he paid, and remember,
is fair.
It is fair. And he said, yes, he did. And he, you know, he was like going for one of those things where he was one of the job creators or something like that. But we know that what Romney essentially does as part of Bain Capital is to ship jobs overseas. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate all of that. I think if you think Obama won that, and it doesn't matter. Remember, I was saying last week that people were saying that that Obama just didn't seem engaged. And I said, what if there was kind of a frumpy, middle-aged or older woman who wasn't very attractive and didn't dress real good and didn't speak real well, and she'd probably get annihilated by Romney or somebody like that if there was a debate. But what we're really interested in is what is her policies? What are her programs?
Right.
What is she going to do for or against the 99% of us?
Right? I mean, look at Sarah Palin. She sucked people in because people
liked
how she looked, yeah.
Until she opened her mouth.
Until she talked, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Remember everybody was afraid that she was going to usher in fascism and all this?
Oh, yeah.
There is an article actually it was a few days ago, in the New York Times called, As Romney Repeats Trade Message, Bain, that's his group, Bain Capital, maintains China ties. So his... Well, you know, he has something
hypocritical.
He has something called a blind trust, where all his $250 million, his $250 million of wealth, you know, he makes. I forgot how much it is. He makes $450,000 a week, by the way.
What?
Yeah.
No.
Let me see. Is that? I just read that.
Oh,
no, that would be
God.
Crazy. So that would be.
Well, but no, it wouldn't be outrageous.
No. That's that would Yeah, it's 500.
Peter, quit doing math on the air.
Yeah, I think that's right. Maybe he makes $250,000 a week. I'm sorry, I exaggerated.
I'm going to get you a calculator.
The tale of Asimco Technologies, an auto parts manufacturer whose plants dot eastern China, would seem to underscore Mitt Romney's campaign trail complaint that China's manufacturing juggernaut is costing American jobs. 9 years ago, the company bought two camshaft factories that employed about 500 people in Michigan. Mm. By 2007, both were shut down. Now, Asimco manufactures the same components in China on a government-donated land site in a coastal region that China has designated an export base where companies are eligible for the sort of subsidies that Mr. Romney says creates an unfair trade imbalance. So, Jesus, does this mean that Romney was correct? But the article in the Times says there's a twist to this story that does not fit neatly into a Romney speech. Since 2010, it's been owned by Bain Capital.
Really?
The private equity firm founded by Mr. Romney, which has as much as $2.25 million invested in three Bain funds with large stakes in this Chinese company, at least seven other Chinese businesses, according to Romney's 2012 candidate financial disclosure and other documents. That and other China-related holdings by Bain funds in which Romney has invested are a reminder of how he inhabits two worlds that at times have come into conflict during his campaign.
Oh.
Well, except the one where he's trying to tell us something is a lie and what, you know. Let's see, where was I? Oh, and then this article just lists all the holdings that that Romney has in Chinese businesses. Last year, Romney's trust sold its stake in an array of foreign holdings, including two Chinese state-owned companies, an oil company, and a bank that had done business in Iran.
Oh, wow.
this guy, man. But Mr. Romney continues to have money in Bain funds with sizable holdings in China. And somewhere or other in this, it's a very, very long article. I guess I didn't underline it. Guess where... Oh, here. The state-controlled Chinese Academy of Sciences has provided free research and development to ASIMCO, which exports at least 15% of its products primarily to the U.S. The authorities also gave company land to build a factory that replaced the plants in Grand Haven, Michigan.
Oh, my gosh.
Thanks, Mitt.
Thanks, Mitten.
Thanks a lot. All right, I'm going to give up. I'm going to try one more time. Maybe nobody has had to come out as an atheist or an agnostic or a non-believer. I would have thought people would have been jumping at the... Maybe it didn't happen. Maybe nobody in our listening audience has had that happen to them. But I wonder what happens when you have a very religious family and you say, Dad, I'm an atheist.
I did it.
Yeah. Why couldn't you be gay? There's also, you know, a lot of gay marriage stuff, marriage equality stuff on the ballot. And there's one man, Frank Schubert, who is a one-man tornado against marriage equality. Talk about that and get your calls when we come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Rocking Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com.
No matter how much our kids amaze us, they can't run for Michigan Supreme Court this year. That's why they need judges who stand up for them.
Michigan Supreme Court candidates Judge Connie Kelly, Judge Sheila Johnson, and family advocate Bridget McCormick have spent their careers protecting families and victims of crime.
From getting criminals off our streets to keeping kids out of gangs, Kelly, Johnson, and McCormick are keeping families safer.
As mothers and advocates for children, Connie Kelly, Sheila Johnson, and Bridget McCormick have zero tolerance for violence against women and kids.
Unlike current Michigan Supreme Court justices who suggest sexual harassment is protected as free speech and ruled corporations have no responsibility to prevent workplace assault or even rape, Kelly, Johnson, and McCormick take violence against women seriously.
Supreme Court candidates Judge Connie Kelly, Judge Sheila Johnson, and family advocate Bridget McCormick.
These three protect families.
Paid for by the Michigan Democratic State Central Committee, not authorized by any candidate committee.
This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com. rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Thank you very much. This is our final segment, so
Get your calls in.
You looked kind of your brow furrowed.
We have some open lines. Yeah. 313-298-9743.
And Julian and I were asking if anybody out there, because we were talking about this news article that said that people that profess no faith and are atheist and are agnostic are growing to the point where the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, are now the second largest group of not religious group, but what would you call it? I mean, there's Catholics, then there's the nuns, N-O-N-E-S.
Just in the category of
religious
beliefs.
Whatever. Beliefs, yeah. Anyway, so we were asking, has anybody out there had to, like, come out to family or friends or business associates or anything, and what was the reaction? And we were surprised that, we have one caller that wants to tell a story. It's Craig and Warren. Craig, hi, it's Peter and Jolene.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, you're on the air. So you, what happened with you?
The reaction I get from people is like, religious people is always like that I'm an unethical person. You know, that they have to like hold their wall. Like, oh, how can you, if you don't believe in God, you don't believe in the rules and you could kill us or they have that. And they always feel like they have to try to save me.
Well, yeah, I know that exact, I know that one. I get that too.
I never get that. You know, I know only religious liberals. So they never, I mean, they would never, intervene. They're all these, pretty gentle people. And so they never say anything to me. I mean, a lot of them listen to this show.
And still talk to you.
And still talk to me.
Yeah, I like to see the looks on their faces, though, when I bring up things like about prayer, since we were little kids, we always just were told prayer, prayer, prayer. But when you really think about what prayer really is, that people believe that they can telepathically communicate with an invisible being that controls everything that they've never seen.
Well, Craig, were you raised religiously?
I went to religious schools, yeah.
Really?
Well, wow.
Well, that's what I was getting at. What happened, and then what happened when you let somebody know that I don't buy this anymore?
It became like they tried to save me. They felt, oh, they started telling me all about the Bible. I've heard all the stories and read the Bible.
Yeah.
And I think the fastest way to make somebody an atheist is read the Bible.
Well, it's a pretty bloody affair.
Yeah, read the Bible, and then tell me if you believe in all this nonsense.
Yeah. So have you ever had any discrimination or any problems in your family or anything like that?
No, nothing like that. I've just had, people react weird, like, oh, my God, you don't believe? We better step back. A lightning bolt might fall from the sky,
Well, that's interesting. I never run into that at all, and it must be just the circles in which I travel.
I don't mean to insult anybody, but I find that the really, really, really religious people, they're not very intelligent.
Well,
I don't mean to insult anybody, but that's just how I feel.
You know what, though? The religious people that I know are very smart people and very engaged and very interested in the same kind of things that I am and what have you. I mean, they sort of break the mold because now the stereotype, and I think that's one of the reasons why religion is losing so many people, is that the stereotype is some dumb bumpkin who thinks that the world was made in 6,000 or in 6 days or 6,000 years ago or whatever, all that stuff. Literal interpretation of the Bible, then doesn't believe in evolution, and is far right wing. And these people do seem, sort of a, sandwich short of a picnic or something like that. So, but, it is the sort of the circles one, runs in. That, and you know, there's
well,
some.
Often, like for me, I experience it when I'm in culinary school at school. Like I run in that circle because I'm going to school.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay.
We did get an email about it from
Craig.
Thank you, Craig. He said he came out as an atheist many years ago as a teenager He said, my family was so horrified that I was forced to undergo counseling through their church. When that didn't work, I was sent away to live with an aunt, being told that they were too ashamed of me to have me living there. Some months later, I was allowed back, but then ambushed with an exorcism. Fun times indeed. My God, you've been through a lot.
Well, you know, actually in my family, and there's some people that in my atheistic family, kind of extended family, that have become religious. And
yes.
No one, you know, we're all kind of rolling our eyes, but we went along with it.
As long as the person's happy, and we know that this person is happy.
Yeah, right.
The one I think we're talking about.
Yep. Well, there's a couple, but,
good people.
Yeah. All right, here's Mike in Grosse Pointe. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. What's
good.
Up?
Hi, Mike.
Well, I just want to talk about the whole atheistic movement kind of thing. I thought it's pretty interesting.
Uh-huh.
I thought about it for some time period, and I can't say whether I am atheistic or not, because I don't know if there is an omnipresent being that, you know, created us or whatever, if it was science, but I at least believe, like, the big rise in it is that we live in this new age of a lot of knowledge out there nowadays, and a lot of technology to get your hands on this knowledge, and especially a lot of people from my generation, younger kids, in their 20s, I don't know. There's a lot more logic, and I'm not saying that people into religion, whether it be Christian or Muslim or whatever, are illogical, but I do find them a little less open-minded to the idea of another way of creation or existence, really.
Well, they can't.
Or other
they
people's
can't, yeah, they can't
feelings be. About it.
I mean, you're... atheism cannot exist on the same plane with theism, you know, and it's not.
Well,
and
I understand that, but these are also the same people who this, like, let's say Christianity has the same story as, like, Mithraism and the Sumerian Book of Creation and Horus the Sun God, and they all kind of have, like, the same idea going with them, but they can't see that, and they say, oh, mine's right and yours wrong, and you're going to go to hell, but I'm fine. And, I'd say they're just not open-minded, and that's why I think there's a big uprise in that.
And also, they do tend to start a lot of wars between one another.
Oh, absolutely, and that's been going on since the dawn of time.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Some people have said it's because that, and Angeline used the phrase earlier tonight, sky gods, is once the political state is established and you start having this hierarchy of rulers, suddenly, you know, you had societies, all these tribes and bands and what have you, that was the way we lived for most of our time on the planet, that were pretty egalitarian. And, that there was a lot of more matriarchal, you know, women, were ruled and what have you. And once they become.
Yeah, women did rule. You said women were ruled. Women ruled.
I did?
Yeah.
Well,
you said it wrong.
Ooh, that's a Freudian slip.
They were not ruled.
I mean, slip.
They ruled.
You missed that.
No, I got it.
You got it.
Peter, I'm used to that one.
Right.
Sometimes I'm unfazed.
Okay. All right. So you have this hierarchy suddenly developing on Earth, the beginning of the political state, and so you got all of a sudden this man claims he's the absolute ruler. This is not the way it always happened. I mean, contrary to anything you may think, tribes and small bands weren't run by one guy at all, even ones were male. We're dominant. But so how are you going to justify a guy ruling over everybody else? Well, it was ordained by the gods. Mm. That's why. And then so he starts establishing this hierarchy. And at the top of it all, besides, you know, the wealthy 1% and sort of the retinue that supports that, the administrators and what have you, then you have to create armed men just in case the rabble get out of hand and start saying, well, wait a minute, why are all of a sudden we used to have a pretty egalitarian society here, like native people in this area did before the European invasion.
Mm, yeah.
And, you know, sometimes the people on the bottom might start thinking, hey, you know, you're taking it all, and we're not, you know, our family.
This is not fair.
This is not fair. And then, boom, out come
the revolt.
The swords and the spears. So,
and, and enough of them being able to do what they want to do.
Yeah. So religion is a very key component in setting up a system of rulers and ruled. In fact, it could not have existed without it. I mean, that's its social function. You can argue forever whether it has any truth to it or not, but the function was to justify and to affirm the right of some to rule over others.
Yeah, the right of suppression.
Yeah. Speaking of that, this is what I said I was going to talk about later. One man guides the fight against gay marriage. Did you read this article?
I did read this
article. And we've heard about him before. Frank Schubert, he's a former corporate public relations executive. And when there was an attempt, pardon me, in something called Proposition 8 in 2008 in California that would have made gay marriage equality, okay, the people opposing it raised $40 million.
Yeah, it was a huge.
Think there was anything else that they might have used $40 million just because you don't want guys marrying guys, do you? Because
it
I don't like
you.
It.
Yeah, that's it.
It's
all
against.
He has.
Yeah.
This guy's creepy too. I saw his picture. He looks creepy.
Well, he has a gay sister.
Oh, and how does he feel about that?
Well, he says that he's not against anybody loving anybody else.
I wouldn't speak to him if
he has a lesbian sister who raises two children in a domestic partnership with another woman.
Yeah.
And he says it's hurtful to know that many people think I dislike gays and lesbians and wish them harm. I like some of my best friends are gays and lesbians. Yeah. He didn't say that.
Well.
So let's give him that he doesn't dislike gays or lesbians. Lesbians.
Because his own sister is.
And that he doesn't wish them any harm. But you know what?
He is harming them.
He's harming them. He's harming them because not recognizing, I mean, there's lots of ways to look at it.
Well, it's like they're not recognizing them as whole people.
Right. And not deserving of the full rights of everyone else. Like, for instance, when you are married to a man and woman are married, there's about like 100 benefits that they get in different aspects of, law and what have you. And if you're just living together, either a man and a woman or, people of the same sex, they're denied that. In fact, that is why the laws against gay marriage and these constitutions like we shamefully have in Michigan are going to be overturned when it becomes the Supreme Court, unless you've got all guys like Antonin Scalia and
right.
What's his pal, Clarence Thomas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Other than that, if they're going to rule on law, there has to be equal protection under the law.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's a thing, all of a sudden I've forgotten, there's another aspect to, due process? No, there's something else. But certainly equal protection under the law. I mean, you can say forever that the Bible forbids it or whatever. Because these were a lot of the same arguments that were put forth in support of segregation.
Ah.
Yeah. I mean, very, very similar. God ordained that the races had to be separate. If they weren't separate, all these bad things would happen. And people were saying that unelected judges are determining social policy rather than the people. And that's what that's Romney's argument as well, and Ryan's. So the deal is, according to Romney and Ryan, we should have left the issue of discrimination in the laws of segregation up to the people of Mississippi.
Oh, yeah, and that would have worked.
Well, let's get everybody to vote here. Well, that is, except for the colored.
Right.
And so how many of us are for continuing segregation? Look at that! 95% of the people. Well,
the majority.
You don't want any northern judges telling us how to run our lives down here in Mississippi. What do you know? You're from Massachusetts and New York and Michigan. So in other words, there has been great decisions made that have altered the nature of life in the United States because it's the continuation of the Democratic Revolution. Although my guest at 1:30 a.m., Gerald Horn, thinks that slavery was embedded in the American Constitution for very strong political reasons, and in some ways the residue of it, not just people's prejudices, but the socioeconomic aspects of slavery and what it provided for wealth accumulation in the early part of the country, that hasn't ended. In any event, there is no legal argument that I can see against legal. You can make all the religious arguments in the world, but then any Supreme Court justice should say, wait a minute, You're making a religious argument in front of the Supreme Court of the United States, where the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law, you know, respecting.
I think someone would bring that up.
Yeah. So we'll see. But you have these hardcore political right wingers sitting on the Supreme Court, because whenever there's a Republican in, the last few have been ideologically committed right wingers. When the Democrats appoint somebody, they put some centrist in.
Yeah.
They barely make it to the left of center.
It's true.
And they ought to just put some, when Obama wins re-election and one of these guys retire, they ought to, put in some left-wing firebrand.
Yeah, I say do it.
Do it, yeah. You know, to even out the ideologues of... That sit on the Supreme Court now, like Scalia and Thomas.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. I did want to say earlier, too, when I was saying I just couldn't believe that anybody that was, I couldn't believe that anyone was making under $250,000 a year would vote for Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. And I couldn't believe that anybody of any wealth with a conscience could. And it disturbed me particularly that people under making under $50,000 a year did. And it is unfortunate fact of life that white people towards the bottom of the economic scale, in a majority, vote for the Republican candidate.
I'll never get it.
Yeah. I mean, even when there's two white guys running. Which I'm not sure what that's all about.
I don't either.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if they think
some kind of power.
Maybe they think thing. If they're nice to the boss.
Yeah. And that'll bode well for them.
They don't.
And it only goes south for them.
And one of the concerns of voters that aren't voting on racism, that are thinking about this, and some of them say, well, we got to get a different economic deal in because Obama has not solved the problem, and Romney and Ryan...
Like, he was going to be able to in 4 years, please.
And Romney and Ryan will, because their plan is...
Wait, there still isn't one, right?
Yeah, no, they've got a secret. They've got a secret.
And they're never going to tell.
Yeah, but, the recession is over, folks. And as I said right at the beginning of the program, maybe it hasn't hit your neighborhood or your job place, or you haven't gotten your job back, or you're working instead of your $50,000-$60,000 a year, you're suddenly down to a job making $20,000, or something like that. But for the people at the top, it's incredible. And here, this article in the Times, a bigger paycheck on Wall Street. So you remember, there's X amount of wealth, and how's it split up? So the poor are getting poorer, the middle class is actually getting poorer,
it's
the working class. Yeah, well, I mean,
kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, it's shrinking.
Shrinking. I like that better.
Okay.
The financial industry in New York has slashed jobs by the thousands over the last couple of years, but for those remaining, the annual compensation in total is at near record levels. The report that the article discusses showed that total compensation on Wall Street last year rose 4% to more than $60 billion. I mean, they're paying their people their $60 billion. Well, and because they can afford it, because they're bringing in incredible amounts of wealth. At the same time, people at the state level and in the community level are arguing about whether you can spend another $150,000 to keep two cops on the job, or whether, you have to let off your whole EMS staff and first responders. These guys are starting to get more and more money. The average pay package of securities industry employees in New York State was $362,950, up 16.6% in the last 2 years. And you got to remember, these guys created no, they didn't create any jobs, did they? In fact, they laid off thousands.
Right?
Well, they brought they didn't bring any
manufacturing. No, not that either.
They helped the community buy...
Wait. Crickets.
They did something. Oh, they moved all this stuff around, sometimes just by cyber trading, and wound up with hundreds and hundreds of millions more, and actually billions of more. So, I don't know. There it is. If you want to vote for your masters and say, thank you, sir. May I have another? Go for it. All right. Time for us to go, but I did want to remind you again about a couple of events, a conference at Wayne State University. I would urge those of you who like this program and figure, and particularly, I mean, you don't have to feel isolated to come. It's not, you know, it's not, you're not going to get a date or anything like that. Or you may, who knows, there's going to be, you know, a party night.
Like-minded people.
Yeah, like-minded people get together. But it's the North American Labor History Conference, but it's going to be a lot about contemporary things. So it's going to be what I try to jam into shorthand. It's going to be a little more deeper explanation of it all. And it's going to be Gerald Horn, who's going to speak about rethinking a revolution, slavery, and the origins of the United States, and also Heather Ann Thompson, another historian, who's written a book called Who's Detroit? Politics, Labor, and Race in a Modern American City. Friday night, there's going to be a cultural event, which will include David Rovick, singer-songwriter, movement, peace and social justice movement troubadour, who's been on this program before. And then Saturday night, David Rovick is going to be appearing at the Cass City Cinema. This is all too much to grasp.
That's a lot.
It is.
Go to PeterWerbe.com.
Go to PeterWerbe.com. That's W-E-R-B-E.com. Go to our Facebook page, Facebook.com/nightcall.
And thank you, John Calvin.
Thank you, Calvin. Appreciate it very much. And maybe let's put him on the spot. They say they're going to provide us next week. I've got to do it to them.
You're terrible.
These, what we call drops.
It's production
that bring us into commercials and out of commercials. So we're all going to be looking for that next week.
God.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com. Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Under the surface, don't
Detroit's Rock Station. On the web, thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Your final chance to fly off for WRIF's Sin City Takeover 2012 is happening today. Listen and win from the Riff.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You may remember last week, if you were listening, I was talking about a conference that's going to be happening in Detroit at Wayne State University. It's the North American Labor History Conference, and on the face of it, probably to a lot of folks, sounds purely academic or not very interesting, you know, kind of boring, because it's not the Tigers beating the A's, you know, it's not Biden and Ryan. But once you get by the entertainment factor of those other two events, don't we want to know about the world in which we live? And that's why I assume most of you are listening to this program, because what we try to do is examine the elements of our lives. What's happening today? What happened yesterday? What did the information about yesterday and today tell us about tomorrow? It's very, very important. And this North American Labor History Conference is not going to be solely academic at all. It's going to have some extraordinarily interesting guests there. I'm going to be there, and I'm actually having a hard time trying to, it's like, you know, a rock concert. You got all these different bands going on at the same time. These will be different sessions, different speakers. You can go to my website for the entire program, and that's Peter Werby, WERBE.com, and I'll be giving the information again. And again, it's Thursday, October 18th through Saturday, the 20th, and it's the North American Labor History Conference. On Friday night, there's an incredible cultural event as well with lots of music and stuff like that. One of the speakers is going to be Dr. Heather Ann Thompson. She's an associate professor of history in the Department of African American Studies and the Department of History at Temple University in Philadelphia. We both realized that I had interviewed her in 2001. She wrote a book about Detroit. It's called Who's Detroit? Politics, Labor, and Race in the Modern American City. And Dr. Thompson is also writing the first comprehensive history of the Attica Prison Rebellion of 1971 and its legacy, and that's going to be out next year. She's also done any number of articles, chapters, and books on crime, punishment, and prison activism during the 60s and 70s in several edited collections. We are reaching her in her office at Temple University in Philadelphia. Professor Thompson, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show, even though it's been a while.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so from what you've seen of this conference, I think this is more than accessible to people that aren't academics, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I mean, anyone who's interested in what's happening in the city of Detroit and what's happening with the labor movement and what's happening with people's lives, this is going to be a great event to kind of unpack, you know, what's happened over time and what is right now.
That's interesting you use that verb, unpack, because one of the people pretty much have simple analyses of events in the world. That is, if we have a lot of crime in big cities like the one you're in, Philadelphia, and the one that I'm in, Detroit, you say, get the cops going, get them, arrest the crooks and put them in jail, and don't let any, you know, kind of teary-eyed sentiment stop that. Tell us, the name of your talk is going to be Urban Labor Affairs in a Time of Mass Incarceration. I think most people know that we lead the world in incarceration. What's it all about, and how does it affect Detroit and cities like ours?
Right. Well, I am a Detroiter, so my own work has always been, in part and very directly, actually, about trying to figure out what's happening in the city that I grew up in, and, you know, how did we get from point A to point B. And so for me, it was really difficult to kind of come back to the city and see what I felt like was so much collapse and yet still so much hope in the city. So I was trying to kind of unpack that, and what I really began to realize was that we needed to start looking more critically at really what happened in Detroit after the 1960s up until the present day. And my first book kind of tried to do that, and now I'm coming at it from a slightly different angle, which is to say, what's happened with the crime and policing in Detroit over time to lead to a situation where, you know, Detroit has, I would argue, really been devastated by the effects, ironically not of crime, although we can talk about that. I mean, that's an important thing to talk about, but really by the effects of mass incarceration. That is to say, how many people in the nation as a whole, but in cities like Detroit in particular, end up ensnared in the criminal justice system that I think really leads to a lot of urban collapse and a lot of economic collapse. And we're just not looking at that piece of it. And I really feel that it's the elephant in the room. So that's what I'd like to call attention to at the conference.
Well, and I'm going to ignore it for a minute. The big elephant in the room, I'm going to ignore it for 1 minute. And tell us, just little people are always curious, because we always say, I mean, if you live in Fenton or Dexter or something like, people often say they live in Detroit. Where, if I may ask, where's your origins in terms of the Detroit area?
Well, I grew up on the northwest side of the city. I grew up in Rosedale Park.
And, oh, so you were actually in the city.
Oh, yeah, and my family still lives there, and I went to Cass Tech High School downtown, so very much a Detroiter.
Now, well, unless I have the wrong photograph, Heather Ann Thompson, you're an associate professor of history in the Department of African American Studies, and unless I have the wrong, do I have the right picture? You're a Euro-American.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So, one would think, well, gee, why does a white lady want to be in the Department of African American Studies?
Well, I mean, again, this sort of goes to the personal biography. I grew up in the city of Detroit, and I grew up as one of the few white girls in my high school, and so for me, understanding African American history is really understanding the history of where I came from, and also understanding the national history through a really important lens. So I've always been very centered in African American history, and to try to tell the story of this city and you know, really to tell the story of many cities in America, I think this is, you know, this is the story, and I take it seriously. And so I was very glad to be a historian, but one who is housed in two different departments, both in history but also in African American studies.
Mm-hmm. And just a personal note, I share some of the same experiences, although I wasn't a white girl. That's the only thing. Dr. Heather Ann Thompson is my guest, and one of the books she's written is Who's Detroit? Politics, Labor, and Race in a Modern American City. She's going to be giving a keynote address at the North American Labor History Conference on Thursday, October 18th, 4 o'clock, the McGregor Memorial at Wayne State University. Everyone's invited. It's free. You can register for the conference, but this event, this talk by Dr. Thompson is free to the public. All right, leaving the elephant in the room of incarceration, when we look at Detroit, if you talk to white people, or I like to call Euro-Americans, over the age, say, of 50, they'll say Detroit was a great city until Coleman Young ruined it. And if people are under 40, they say, oh, Detroit was not so good, but then Kwame Kilpatrick ruined it. So it's put the troubles of Detroit are put at the hands of the incompetence and corruption and the foibles of two African-American mayors. How do you speak to that?
Well, the first part, I think, the blaming the collapse of the city of Detroit on Coleman Young is a very kind of simplistic way of understanding Detroit's history. I mean, first of all, Detroit in the 50s, which was very prosperous economically, was deeply, deeply troubled in terms of its social fabric. It was the site of extraordinary police brutality, particularly for the black community, and extraordinary job discrimination and inequities in housing and in education. And so one of the reasons why Detroit in the 60s becomes so much in turmoil is because many black Detroiters, and in fact, an increasingly half of the city residents, were feeling very disfranchised by the city politics. And so Coleman Young comes out of a longer struggle for taking equality seriously in the city of Detroit. And it wasn't just a black-white thing. I mean, many white allies of the civil rights movement stood by Coleman Young in his election. So, you know, first of all, it wasn't as wonderful for everybody prior to Coleman Young's election. And secondarily, when Coleman Young gets elected, it's a very tricky thing we have have to unpack, because while there had been some pretty substantial white flight to the suburbs prior to his election because of the industrialization beginning, there is no question that when we get a black mayor elected, don't forget when he's elected in 73, the city's 50-50, and when a black mayor is elected, almost immediately white folks abandon the city. And yet, you know, I sort of argue in my work that Coleman Young in some respects becomes the captain of a slowly sinking ship, because with white flight went a tremendous amount of resources. So without getting into the personality of Coleman Young, and one could argue about whether he made that better or worse, but certainly the population shift that happens in response to the election of a black mayor is a fundamental part of this story. And Michigan subsequently loses a big, I'm sorry, Detroit loses a big chunk of the resources of Michigan over time. So the in some respects it's very disingenuous to say that Detroit was rosy and good until black political leaders take power.
Mm-hmm. I would add, and you mentioned it, about the deindustrialization was already beginning. In fact, it had begun in the 1950s, not to Europe, but to the American South to escape good middle-class union wages. And the other thing you continually hear from people is that as soon as Coleman Young was elected, he told white people to get out of Detroit. And this, I mean, it's extraordinary how this I don't know what you'd call it, this statement is repeated and has nothing to do with reality. What he said, he told, and it was probably a badly framed statement, he told criminals, he was going to fight crime, he told criminals to hit 8 Mile Road. In other words, to get out of town, that he wasn't going to tolerate it. And first off, people took it, when they heard it, they were saying, well, the criminals should go to the suburbs, which wasn't very good. And the second, but then it got totally transformed into somehow that Coleman Young told white people to get out of Detroit, which...
Right, and it's just completely inaccurate. I mean, if you look at any city service, what happens when Coleman Young gets elected is that the fire department gets integrated, the police department gets integrated. It does not become primarily African-American, and in fact, it does not become primarily African-American for decades and decades and decades. And that has much more to do, again, with the effects of white flight than in hiring practices. Clear up until the 90s, I mean, many city departments still were, you know, had huge numbers of white employees in them. So that was just inaccurate. And the whole issue of crime fighting, that's an important thing because, of course, he had run against John Nichols, who was the police commissioner, had the former police commissioner, who ran on an anti-crime platform. And Coleman Young was saying, no, we're not going to brook with criminals either. So, yeah, I think the distortion of what happens to Detroit, though, is fundamentally what I'm interested in, because I think it's really important, because Detroit becomes kind of every city, right? You know, what happens to Detroit seems to be this metaphor for what happens to urban America, and so I think it's really important to get the story straight.
My guest is Dr. Heather Ann Thompson. She's an associate professor of history at the Department of African American Studies and the Department of History at Temple University in Philadelphia. She's going to be one of the interesting keynote speakers at the conference, at the North American Labor History Conference. Thursday, October 18th is when she'll be speaking, 4 p.m. at the McGregor Memorial on the Wayne State University campus. It's free and open to the public. There is a registration fee for the entire conference. I would urge people to go. No one will be turned away for lack of funds. And if you'd like to see more details on that, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. Well, all right, we mentioned earlier that mass incarceration is the elephant in the room that no one talks about. Let's do that. Now, I think, again, the simplistic explanation would be African-American people commit a disproportionate amount of crime, and they're apprehended properly, as probably people think less than they need to be, and then put in prison. What's the problem here? I mean, you have mass incarceration because you have mass crime.
Well, I mean, There's so many problems. I mean, first of all, again, we need to get the chronology straight. The war on crime, that is to say, you know, the massive investment in a bureaucracy to fight crime at the federal level that then trickles down to local dollars in police departments, really predates the rise in crime that will come to paralyze cities in the 80s and the 90s. And in fact, one of the biggest ironies about this is that we get a major crime-fighting apparatus, not with Nixon, but in fact with Lyndon Johnson, with passage of the Law Enforcement Administration in 1965. And of course, in 1965, not only was crime not rampant, but in fact it was lower than it had been, substantially lower than it had been at other points in time, the 30s, the 20s. So the question really becomes, why do we get a war on crime in the first place? And in many cities, the war on crime is really generated and started as a reaction not to crime per se, but actually to social disruption. So to the civil rights movement, to the disruption in the streets of places like Detroit or Watts. And so later on, as this thing, it has a bureaucracy and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and what we very quickly start to see is a rise in incarceration rates that is in many respects independent from the crime rate. So, for example, in Michigan, the incarceration rate goes up 530% between 1973 and 2007, but the crime rate fluctuates, and in fact, the incarceration rate keeps going up even when the crime rate goes lower and lower and lower. So there's a real disconnect between the incarceration rates and the crime rates, and yet it has enormous implications for the way people see African Americans, the way people see cities. And so that's part of what I'm trying to do, is to bring attention to what I think is really the crisis of mass incarceration more than the crisis of crime. In fact, we have an incredibly low crime right now, which is not to say, and I'll make this brief, but it's not to say that certain neighborhoods are not deeply victimized by crime. So we do need to talk about that. And what I would argue is that those areas that are still suffering such serious crime have, and this is one of the greatest ironies that scholars are trying to unpack right now, have suffered this crime in part because of mass incarceration, and I'm happy to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you thankfully spend much more time thinking about this than I do, and I'm kind of given to simplistic answers myself. And I wonder, though, is there something deeper to it? One of the things I always say on the talk shows I do, particularly the phone-in talk show that I do, is that what is needed is this: our clients for the prison industrial system. And I know you've written a piece called "Downsizing the Carceral State," the prison state, the policy implications of prisoner guard unions. So you have all these towns with little towns in upstate New York and upstate Michigan and all that are pretty much dependent on a continuing rate of incarceration. And of course you have these unions that are providing income from the state for people. So is there a prison industrial complex, and am I oversimplifying when I say
no? I mean, there absolutely is. There's no question that crime is big business, and particularly now that there's an enormous number of private corporations that literally make money every time someone gets arrested and incarcerated, right? The beds are filled, and it's not just making money from the prison construction. It's also it's those who both manufacture and sell everything from tampons to tasers to telephones, right? That this is an enormous money generating industry. So that is definitely true. But we have to, and also prison labor. I mean, there's just so many facets of this, and I will hopefully unpack them in an organized fashion when I give the talk at the Wayne State Conference. But in short, we need to really first look at, I think, what are the social effects of this, right? What are the effects of this on cities like Detroit? And I would argue that they are absolutely devastating. It has orphaned generations of children. It has impoverished areas of Detroit to the point of literal collapse. We have a name for these blocks that have been so devastated by incarceration. They're called million-dollar blocks because that's what it costs to now house all of these people behind bars. And yet people will say, well, you know what, you commit the crime, you do the time. But when we look really closely at this, what we quickly figure out is that crimes themselves have been, the nature of what we consider crimes changed dramatically after the 70s. First of all, we get the drug war. So there's a hugely disproportionate number of people who are arrested for drug offenses, but also primarily for being drug addicts, that is to say, people in need of medical. This is a public health issue. But also, the sentencing has changed so dramatically, particularly in places like Michigan. So many people go to prison now that wouldn't have before, but also stay in prison so much longer. Indeed, you know, after 1981 in Michigan, the average length that a prisoner stayed in prison in Michigan grew by over 50%. So what we have to really look at is, you know, so someone's selling the dime bag on the corner. The question is, what is the penalty for that now versus what it used to be? The question is, what is the sentence for that? And what I'm suggesting is we also need to look at what is the fallout from that. Kids losing their parents, parents getting out of prison, absolutely unemployable. And in many states, they not only can they not get a job, but they are absolutely banned from welfare benefits, which then increases the cycle of poverty. And so it is causing social devastation that one could say it's sort of a chicken and an egg, but in fact, it isn't a chicken and an egg. I mean, we can really locate what starts this. One way to think about it, I encourage people to kind of stop and consider this for a minute. You know, it isn't that America just lost its mind after 1970 and 2 million people went on a criminal rampage. What happens is laws are fundamentally changed. Sentencing gets much more punitive. Prisons become big business. For the first time after 1979, corporations can access prisoner labor again. They hadn't been able to do that since after the Civil War. Major changes happen that help to explain how cities like Detroit completely collapse as a result, not of crime, but actually the effects of mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Thompson, you've just been named to a National Academy of Sciences panel to study the causes and consequences of high rates of imprisonment in the U.S., and you've been mentioning some of those. It's a 2-year, $1.5 million project sponsored by the National Institute of Justice and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. I guess one of the things that I would say, there's a lot of poor people in this country, and poor people disproportionately commit crimes more so than middle class and upper class. Well, you know, the Pretty Boy Floyd song by Woody Guthrie, some men will rob you with a fountain pen, others, some will rob you with a six gun, others with a fountain pen. And so it's the one that we usually worry about, I don't know why, more so, is the ones with the six gun. Anyways, the poverty level of the wealthiest country in the world surely has to be a motivator for the crime that does exist.
Well, and that's actually the crux of why we can't just look at crime in isolation. We have to look at the link between incarceration and crime, the inverse relationship. Because, yes, crime overall in the nation is extremely low, and yet our incarceration rate is disproportionately high. Well, when you look at a certain neighborhood on the east side of Detroit, you might say, well, that's, you know, we arrest people where the crime is, but in fact, it's so much more complicated than that. Last year in New York City, just to give you an example, 700,000 people were stopped and frisked on the street. Now, that was targeting disproportionately African Americans, targeting disproportionately African American neighborhoods. So what do you suppose that's going to net, particularly if what is a crime is low-level drug crimes? And what I always tell my students at Temple, if I do a big lecture of 150 students, I say, well, you know what? If the police came in here right now and did a major stop and frisk and targeted you as an audience, how many of you would be behind bars tonight, right?
Yeah, do you get any hands raised?
Oh, I get a lot of
really?
Looks, right? Because they're all thinking about what's this, you know, what's either, you know, the illegal alcohol, the illegal drug. I mean, you know, of course, disproportionate targeting of certain neighborhoods is going to lead to certain neighborhoods being disproportionately arrested. And, again, then you have the fallout, which is desperation, poverty, which, yes, is going to lead to even more crimes of opportunity. It's going to lead to more gun crimes. It's going to lead to more drug abuse, more drug selling. So it is a seriously important that we unpack this chicken and egg, because unless we want to be a nation that literally locks up everybody that is poor, we have to address this as a social issue. Right now, there's more than 7 million people in this country ensnared in the system.
Hmm.
You know, 65 million people with some form of a criminal record over time. And this matters because those people can't vote. In some places in the country, many, many, 48 states have some form of disfranchisement law. These people can't get aid in many states. These people can't get jobs because employers won't hire them. These people can't get college educations because they're also barred from educational institutions. So this is a social crisis. And
it is. And I'm sorry, I'm just cutting you off because we are out of time. It's not bothering me so much because I'm going to come hear your keynote talk at the North American Labor History Conference on Thursday, October 18th. It's going to be at 4:00 in the McGregor Memorial. It's free and open to the public. And the conference goes on Friday and Saturday as well. It's completely accessible in terms of, well, just as Professor Thompson has laid this out so well today. It's not for academics. I never graduated college, folks, so don't be intimidated by the fact that it's on a university campus. You can find out all the information about the conference and a link also to Dr. Thompson's site by going to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Professor Thompson, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
Thank you, and I hope I'll see you all at Wayne.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Thanks for rocking with the riff online. This is WRIF.com.
No matter how much our kids amaze us, they can't run for Michigan Supreme Court this year. That's why they need judges who stand up for them.
Michigan Supreme Court candidates Judge Connie Kelly, Judge Sheila Johnson, and family advocate Bridget McCormick have spent their careers protecting families and victims of crime.
From getting criminals off our streets to keeping kids out of gangs, Kelly, Johnson, and McCormick are keeping families safer.
As mothers and advocates for children, Connie Kelly, Sheila Johnson, and Bridget McCormick have zero tolerance for violence against women and kids.
Unlike current Michigan Supreme Court justices who suggest sexual harassment is protected as free speech and ruled corporations have no responsibility to prevent workplace assault or even rape, Kelly, Johnson, and McCormick take violence against women seriously.
Supreme Court candidates Judge Connie Kelly, Judge Sheila Johnson, and family advocate Bridget McCormick.
These three protect families.
Paid for by the Michigan Democratic State Central Committee, not authorized by any candidate committee.
Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, I do a lot of history interviews on this broadcast, and I don't do it because it's, quote, interesting, although history to me is exceedingly interesting because it gives us an idea of how we got here, who we are. I mean, we just didn't drop here from outer space. There's a history going back, well, of course, millions of years in some regard, but understanding history means you can understand the past, understand the present, and get an idea of what we should do for the future. And so a lot of history. Also, you know, there's a lot of theories about what history is. Our own, boy, I hate to associate with him, our own Henry Ford said history is bunk. George Santayana, who was a famous philosopher, and also, of course, famously distorted this one little quote. I'm just trying to get it up here. He said, the one who does not remember history is bound to live through it again. It's kind of said in a lot of different ways. Also, though, history are the stories that any culture or society tells itself, usually how great we are. Right? There's also a branch of history called revisionist history, is that we look at the official histories and revise it in terms of new information and what have you. Probably the most famous historian doing that, and one who I interviewed quite a few times, was the late Howard Zinn. Also, an historian, incredible historian, a prolific historian, is Gerald Horn. He's an historian who currently holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He has a PhD from Columbia University and a Doctor of Jurisprudence from the University of California at Berkeley, and has written numerous books. I interviewed him about black and brown, African Americans in the Mexican Revolution, race war, white supremacy, and the Japanese attack on the British Empire. The final victim of the blacklist, John Howard Lawson, dean of the Hollywood 10. And if some of these, if you just from the titles, can't tell what they are, check them out. They're extraordinarily interesting. Also, the deepest South, the United States, Brazil, and the African slave trade. Now, one thing that is sacrosanct is that we all know that a great movement forward for humanity was the American Revolution and the other democratic revolutions of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. We blew away the idea of the right of kings. We no longer were subjects. We became citizens. And we, with this American exceptionalism, has something to offer the entire world. Well, let's look at that from the perspective of Gerald Horn. He's probably thinking, am I ever going to get on the air? Indeed. Gerald Horn is going to be speaking at the North American Labor History Conference. It goes from Thursday, October 18th through Saturday, October 20th. So that's coming right up. And Gerald Horn is going to be giving a keynote talk on Friday, October 19th at 5:15 at Wayne State's McGregor Memorial. All this will be on my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And this is not just for academics at all. This is for ordinary people, even a college dropout like myself. And Gerald Horn's topic is going to be Rethinking a Revolution, Slavery, the Origins of the U.S., and the Implications of the International Working Class. We're reaching Professor Horn at his office at the University of Houston. Welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I bet you were wondering whether you'd get a chance to say anything here, but here you are. Rethinking a Revolution. Good to always rethink all of our histories, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And let me pick up on some of the points you made in your introductory remarks. Certainly, 1776, the Declaration of Independence, led to the overthrow of monarchy in North America. But keep in mind that in 1965, in the British colony then known as Southern Rhodesia, Ian Smith led a white minority regime in an attempt to overthrow the monarchy in that part of Africa. Now, I doubt if few would suggest that if Ian Smith had been successful, that would have been a step forward for humanity. In my remarks and in a book that will be published next year that expand upon what I'm saying, I argue that 1776 was initiated in no small part to forestall the rise of the abolitionist movement, the abolition of slavery movement in London, just as Ian Smith's movement in 1965 in Southern Rhodesia was designed to forestall decolonization. And I dare say that forestalling decolonization nor forestalling abolition of slavery should be considered a step forward for humanity. In order to understand 1776, you should understand, for example, 1772. It was June 1772 in a London courtroom that Somerset's case was basically ruled on by a London judge, which suggested that abolition was coming to the British Empire. And this helped to trigger anxieties amongst the colonists, not least in Virginia, going southward down to Georgia, because they already had this idea that the British were going to be aligning with the Africans against themselves. Keep in mind that for various reasons, the European powers had come to rely heavily upon African soldiers. Now, Spain was a pioneer in this regard. As early as the 1500s, you had Africans who were in the Spanish military, particularly in Spanish Cuba, but as well in Spanish Florida. Note that the United States doesn't take over Florida until about 180, 190 years ago, and from the 1500s up until the United States basically takes over, which is about 1819, with a short interregnum for British rule in the 18th century, Florida had basically been a Spanish colony. And the Spanish had routinely and repeatedly sent Africans across the border into British territory, in particular South Carolina, which had a black majority, to rile up the slaves. In fact, the largest and most significant revolt of the enslaved during the colonial period was in South Carolina, Stonewall's Revolt, 1739-1740, which was basically instigated by so-called Spanish Negroes. So this was part of a repeated pattern, and Britain was under significant competitive pressure to respond to Spain's basically arming Africans. So it felt that it had to do so as well. This competitive pressure and competition comes to a head, interestingly enough, in Cuba in 1762, when Britain basically overthrows Spanish rule, at least temporarily, in Spanish Cuba. And they do this not least because they're deploying armed Africans. They're also conscripting European settlers from the 13 colonies, that is to say from New York, from Virginia, etc. But what's interesting about this British army in Cuba is that London basically rules that the Africans should share in the booty alongside the European conscripted settlers. This is outraging these European settlers, because what it really means is that they're being treated like Africans, which in some minds means that they're being treated like slaves. And this helps to instigate further their resentment of London, which leads directly to 1776. I should also add that one of the reasons that the European powers have to employ Africans has to do, in many ways, with what you see unfolding on the world scene today. What do you see unfolding on the world scene today? Well, there is the prospect, for example, of Scottish independence sooner rather than later in what is now the United Kingdom. Recall that Scotland really doesn't become an official part of the UK until 1707, but then there are major revolts in 1715 and the mid-1740s. The British, that is to say London, does not see the Scots as necessarily being politically reliable, which means they're reluctant to put arms in their hands. We also know, I would assume your audience knows, about the conflicts and contradictions between London and the Irish, which stretches back centuries, well before the conflict with Scotland in some ways. And this means that London is also reluctant to put guns in the hands of the Irish as well. And so almost by process of elimination, that basically leaves the Africans to arm. But at the same time, you have Scottish and Irish moving into the 13 colonies, not least because they feel that their opportunities are circumscribed in the British Isles. When they arrive in the 13 colonies, they don't necessarily they're not necessarily pro-London just by crossing the Atlantic. In fact, you can fairly say that these disgruntled Irish and Scots are in the forefront of the revolt against London's rule in North America. So if you stir the pot, you'll begin to see how and why it was that Britain had come to rely heavily upon the Africans, and as a result, they had to move towards abolition because enslaving the Africans and arming them was obviously contradictory and inconsistent, to put it mildly. Likewise, with regard to Spain, you might have noted that just a few weeks ago in Barcelona, the industrial powerhouse of Spain, you had tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets protesting, not least against Madrid's rule. This is a protest that actually goes back to about 1714, when Catalonia, which is that region of Spain of which Barcelona is the center, basically came under the domination of Madrid. And ever since then, there has been attempts for Catalonia to secede. I dare say that, like Scotland, there is a strong possibility that Catalonia will secede, particularly given the financial problems you see in Madrid.
Well, let me do this. My guest is historian Gerald Horn, and we're talking this somewhat of a preview of his keynote address that he's going to be giving at the North American Labor History Conference on Friday, November 19th. It's 5:15 at the McGregor Memorial at Wayne State University, and it's free and open to the public. The whole conference has a slight registration fee. No one will be turned away for lack of funds. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, get the full schedule of all of this as well. And Dr. Horn, you were speaking about the Somerset decision in which the possibility of the abolition of slavery in Britain and throughout the British Empire would be abolished, and this would have been an impetus for the revolt of against the homeland, against Britain, by the southern colonies. But what about these men who wrote the Constitution from Massachusetts and New York and Vermont and what have you? How did they relate to that idea?
Well, John Hancock, as you may know, was a slave owner. John Adams, the second president of the United States, who then was the father of John Quincy Adams, who also served as president of the United States, was a lawyer for slave owners. It's important to keep in mind that in terms of these colonies, that slavery was the locomotive that drove these colonies. That is to say that if you take a state or a colony like Rhode Island, in many ways was the epicenter of the African slave trade. That is to say that the ships were deporting from Newport for Africa and then buying Africans and depositing them in the Americas. The profits were gigantic, enormous, eye-watering, sometimes as much as 1,700%. These profits then were diverted, if you like, into other industries, such as insurance, for example, such as banking, such as shipbuilding, for example, which becomes a major enterprise of the New England states. So it's difficult to separate this enterprise that was slavery from all of the colonies. And just another point, just to put a fine point on the point about Spain that I was mentioning, because of the separatism in Catalonia and the presumed unreliability of those in that part of Spain, that gave an impetus for Madrid also to arm Africans. Now, basically, if listeners are wondering what was happening in the 17th and 18th century and the founding of this nation known as the United States, what does it have to do with today? Well, basically, what I'm arguing is that I don't think that the U.S. progressive movement has had an adequate diagnosis of this country, which helps to explain why the progressive movement in this country is so weak, because a doctor has to have an adequate medical history in order to make an adequate diagnosis. And I think that the progressive movement has missed the point, which I'm making, and which I should also say a number of European scholars have made recently, which is that 1776 was really the founding of the first apartheid state. And I don't think that today's progressive movement has come to grips with this, which is one of the reasons why they find it difficult to understand how and why it was, for example, in 1991, that 55% of the white population in Louisiana voted for a Klansman and a Nazi, David Duke, for governor. And I don't think that they've come to grips with how deeply entrenched that racism and slavery was in the fabric of the founding of the United States, it wasn't just a sideshow. It wasn't just something that people forgot to address as they were moving towards liberty and freedom, which is the usual narrative. And that until you come to grips with this, you won't be able to come to grips with how and why you can transform the United States. Another point that I make is that particularly for the population that we now refer to as African American, the descendants of the enslaved Africans in North America, that the progress for this group historically has come not least from international currents. We know that during the Cold War, for example, one of the reasons the United States moved away from Jim Crow during that period was because of it was difficult to charge Moscow with human rights violations when African peoples were treated so atrociously in the United States. This creates a dynamic that leads to the retreat of Jim Crow, as the Supreme Court says in its 9-0 decision in Brown versus Board of Education on May 17, 1954. In my most recent book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans of the British Empire Fight the United States Before Emancipation, I point out that you can't understand the dissolution, the disintegration of slavery, until you understand the pressure that was being placed on the United States by London, by the abolitionist movement in London, but also by the government of London, in London, which had to an extent been won over to abolition. This comes clear during the War of 1812, which, as you know, is being celebrated across the water in Windsor,
yes,
Ontario, but is going curiously unremarked in Michigan. Because part of the essence of the War of 1812 was an attempt by the United States, dominated by slave owners, to seize Canada, because Canada had become a sanctuary for fleeing Africans. Canada then was under London's rule, as you know. And this desire to seize Canada, I should say, in all fairness, going back to the 18th century. And as a partial result, you saw that the African population in the United States basically defected en masse to the Union Jack, to the Canadian side, to the London side. And they were involved, for example, in that event that has been forgotten largely on this side of the border, August 1814. When the White House is basically burned to a crisp, President James Madison and his garrulous spouse, Dolly, sent fleeing into the streets with the Union Jack soldiers, including Africans, chasing them through the streets of Washington, D.C. And so my point is that if you want to understand how we got to this point where we are today, where in presidential elections, basically you have a choice between the right and the center, with then internecine conflicts erupting between and amongst those on the left as to whether or not you should support the center, that is to say the Democrats, or whether you should not support the center, and the relative weakness of the left in the United States compared to Germany, where you've had a green foreign minister, compared to France, where today you have a socialist president, compared to even Japan, where the Communist Party of Japan Sunday newspaper outsells the New York Times Sunday newspaper. You have to understand the conservative, indeed apartheid-like origins of the United States and the unwillingness or inability of progressive forces to acknowledge this, which means they don't come up with adequate or accurate diagnoses, which means they're left in a marginal position.
Let me pose this to you, Dr. Horn. And, you know, there's always, I don't know what this says. There's obviously different ways of looking at things. I find everything you say and all the books I've interviewed you about that you've written very compelling and very important and a necessary rereading of American history. You keep mentioning the word progressive, and sure. Here could be the counter argument. Everything you say is true, yet we're limping along. There still is this residual racism that's actually on a mass scale, to be sure. But we have achieved any number of things through a lot of blood and suffering. I mean, from slavery, through the Civil War, through the Civil Rights Movement, and the continuing disparity in income and services and everything that people of African origin in this country suffer today. But given that origin, you know, we're moving forward, and I know I can imagine what you'll say about that. The very fact that we have an African American president that probably will be reelected has to say something that we're moving along. Or do you say no?
Oh, no. I agree. It says something. The question is, what does it say?
Okay.
What I think it says is that we've been able in North America to take advantage of global currents, such as the Cold War, and being able to weave that into an anti-Jim Crow thrust in the 1950s and the 1960s. I think, as I said about my previous book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, we were able to take advantage of London's abolitionist movement to force the destruction of slavery. And I think today the problem is that the movement in this country has become too insular. That is to say, it's not necessarily trying to align with global forces in order to force change in the United States. It sees the United States basically as a thing in itself, and that all the change has to sort of come within the four corners of this country, amongst the 314 million people that reside under the U.S. flag. And I say that that goes against the grain of history, and that therefore the progressive movement should be seeking to link up with movements abroad. I think a mistake was made, quite frankly, in 1999, which the progressives in this country tend to see as a high watermark during the Battle of Seattle over the accession to the World Trade Organization. Many of the progressives were saying, well, we're against the World Trade Organization because it circumscribes U.S. sovereignty. Well, my counter is that oftentimes progressive forward movement, particularly for black Americans, has only come when U.S. sovereignty has been circumscribed, which is one of the many reasons you can see that many darker faces in the streets during the Battle of Seattle. And that there's one more point I should also make, too, which is that I think that we have to try to understand the present-day tenuous position of the black American population through a particular lens. What I mean by that is that if you want to understand the high rates of incarceration, the United States incarcerating more people proportionally virtually than any other country in the world, with about half of those being black, although the blacks are only about 12 or 13% of the U.S. population, I think you have to understand this reality that more blacks fought alongside London in 1776 during that war than fought with the victorious settlers. That during the War of 1812, once again, you had this massive defection to the other side. And that there is a sort of, it's not just racism, although that's a large part of the explanation of what afflicts the black population. It's also a political question. That is to say that these descendants of mainland enslaved Africans, to a certain degree, are still being punished. And what I mean, you can see that further if you look at the history of music. For example, you may be familiar with Babs Gonzalez,
mm-hmm.
who played with Lionel Hampton's
sure.
band, born Lee Brown in Newark, now New Jersey. You know, he changed his name because, like the early Negro baseball teams, which called themselves Cubans, the New York ex-Cubans, the New York Cubans, or as represented in the Richard Pryor movie, Bingo Long's Traveling All-Stars, when the Negro League teams try to act like they're Cubans.
Great film.
Speak gibberish on the field. And,
yeah.
To make people think that they're bad.
You know, we got about a minute left, so let me get you to sum up here.
So the point is that they were trying to escape this identity of being descendants of mainland African enslaved persons. They were still dark-skinned, but they thought that they were viewed as Cuban or Mexican, in the case of Babs Gonzalez, that somehow they would escape persecution. This goes directly to my thesis in terms of the political component that we have to understand in explicating the tenuous situation today of the African-American population.
I want to thank you so much. When I said earlier, introducing Professor Gerald Horn, that he is prolific both in writing and in speaking. And if challenging our core beliefs is something I always appreciate, because either when you're just believing something, re-examining it is extraordinarily important. And Gerald Horn is an incredible treasure for this. He's written numerous books. I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B. WRBE.com. I'll also have a link to the event that Gerald Horn is going to be speaking at on Friday, October 19th, coming right up, 5:15 at the McGregor Memorial at Wayne State. It's part of the North American Labor History Conference. It goes Thursday, October 18th to Saturday, October 20th, and there'll also be a link to that on my page as well. Gerald Horn, thanks so much for being a guest on my show again.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Get all of Drew and Mike's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. The Drew and Mike Podcast, brought to you by Matt's Jewelry Brokers. For fast cash, call Matt's at 586-286-2866. Subscribe today at WRIF.com.
WRIF HD1 Detroit. Your
final chance to fly off for WRIF's Sin City Takeover 2012 is happening today. Listen and win from the Riff.